For tuning in. You are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. My name is Colin. I am back again with Dom for a very special episode today. Dom, first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. But more importantly, Scott and Mike, who are our guests today, I guess, I don't know if this is the Dom and Colin podcast anymore, the Scott and Mike podcast, but either way, we're glad to have you on with us.
Yeah, hello, Internet. You're listening to Genius Cast.
let's try to get them one at a time and set them up. So let's start with you, Scott. Scott is, of course, Scott and Mike together are the co-hosts of Genius Cast, big fans of another one of our favorite shows, The Genius, of course. Any regular listeners of this podcast will have heard us talk about that all the time. But Scott, tell us about yourself just in general and why you are so interested in talking about the election with us and why we'd be so interested in talking about the election with you.
Sure. Yeah, I'm a professional magician. My job is to tell fart jokes to children, and then their parents give me money, which is a pretty sweet gig if you can get it. I've been doing this full-time for about 6 years. I'm a married father of two. I have two young kids. I live in Chicago. I am qualified to talk politics and election stuff because I have a degree in political science from the University of Illinois. I have a law degree also. I had a focus and studied on some unique aspects of political science, including the intersection of politics and genomics.
What are genomics?
Well, that was the name of the class. Just the way that our genetics can affect our political positions, which is something I think that is woefully understudied. The way that there, believe it or not, there are certain political positions that you are more or less likely to be influenced by. So genetics has a major bearing on your stance on tax policy, for example. This is true. But if you were campaigning for office and you wanted to change someone's mind, tax policy is a tough thing to do it on because it is literally encoded into our genetics, how we're predisposed to feel about it. And then there's other – and I've been trying to find my paper that I wrote and I can't find it. But there's some issues that you're more likely to be influenced by outside factors.
Oh, wow. That's actually really, really interesting. So you're just at a really young age, just set – it's just kind of coded into you?
Yeah, and they've done this based on twin studies. So and the math on this is actually fairly straightforward when you have sets of identical and fraternal twins. And then you can you look at their ratio of the similarity of positions on certain topics. You can fuss out what portion of their opinion essentially is genetic. What portion of it is from their shared environmental experience, home life or the things that they do together as they develop, and then what percentage of it is from non-shared experiences. So
it's like nature versus nurture equity.
Yeah, and believe it or not, it's surprisingly some topics are hardwired into your system. Even something like I said, the one that I always remembered is tax policy, where your willingness to give tax cuts to the rich depends in part on your DNA coding.
Okay, potentially more on that later. Let's move over to Mike Botta. Mike, how are you?
Good. Hey guys.
Go for it.
Well, I was going to say thanks for having us because obviously when other podcasts send their people, they're not sending their best. But Scott and I assume, are good people.
Yeah, I think we got the top two from your podcast to appear on this podcast so far.
That's right.
Yeah, Mike, tell us about yourself.
So I'm a health economist by background. I did a PhD in health economics, and I worked in the Obama administration in the first year of it. So I worked in the Office of Management and Budget in the Food, Health, and Labor Division for a little bit, which you may have heard there was a big healthcare thing that happened at that point. So hopefully I can speak to that.
Any quick terminology for that?
Something like Hussein Aid, Hussein Med. I think that's what we went with.
Yeah. As far as your what degrees do you have? I know we were speculating this podcast as the time that we're recording this hasn't been released. Dom thought you had a PhD. I thought it might be an MBA. What's your background in that department?
Yeah, it's a PhD.
Okay.
In
health sciences.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. And Dom, I know you're obviously a regular on this podcast, to say the least, but something we don't often talk about is just kind of your background education-wise. Tell us about your experience and your degrees.
Well, a degree singular so far. I mean, I have a, I guess, political science is what you guys would call it, degree from Oxford. It's called PPE, which is, if you ever hear people complain about the political class in the UK, it's all of these rich white boys from Oxford who went and did PPE. So I am the problem, basically, and this is my own attempt to remedy that. But yeah, that's my kind of qualification for talking about this. And also, I assume if you're listening to this in the first place, you have probably listened to other episodes at some point and have some kind of frame of reference for who we are and what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, have you? How closely has England in general been paying attention to this election? Is an interesting place, I think, to start. Is it something that prior to Trump winning was big on the European radar?
So mostly people were just transfixed with horror at the idea that Trump was a viable candidate, and obviously when he actually won, just aghast that this could even happen. But there's naturally, just because of the nature of a presidential race and also the specific people involved, a lot of focus has been on Trump in a lot of focus has been on Trump, and less so about what are the implications of the Republicans controlling the House and the Senate, or the kind of state governor's races, the Supreme Court implications, and so on. So hopefully we can kind of elucidate some of those things in the course of what should be a fairly detailed discussion.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the way that we're going to be hopefully trying to set this up is first get into kind of how we got to this point, the big surprise on election night, and then after that kind of transition into where we go now, what we may end up seeing play out on, you know, once we come, you know, transition into the era of President Trump.
Right. And we'll give the disclaimer at the start that as a panel, we are not representative of the entire electorate or the range of views within the electorate, or of the people who stand to lose the most potentially from what President Trump could end up doing. So we will bear that in mind as we go. We're not claiming to speak for everyone, but hopefully we can offer some decent perspectives here.
Yeah, so I think let's get into it. And I think, Scott, I'll throw the first question to you, which explain to me in political science terms, I guess, your take on how Trump even got to this point, because this time, even a year ago, he wasn't even the leading contender among the plethora of people vying for the GOP nomination, and now he's about to become president.
Well, I don't want to be like too glib, but to borrow a phrase from 16 years ago, strategery. Mm-hmm. Like basically, I think it took a lot of strategy at multiple points that were beyond the candidate's own comprehension, and he happened to just wind up being the beneficiary of a couple decades of GOP attempts to polarize the electorate and then try to flush out some of the voters that they didn't like, and to motivate the others on some pretty dangerous grounds. So I think that's probably where it starts.
Okay, interesting. And do you feel like how much of a role – do you feel like that's almost purely because of the way he was able to harness the media? Because to me – that is probably the most fascinating part of this whole thing for me, is just how well he was able to play up getting so much free airtime, which seems so critical in the year 2016.
Well, it doesn't help that so CNN is seen as like the moderate cable news provider, but CNN is being run right now by Jeff Zucker, who I think is a friend of Donald Trump's, right?
And hired him for The Apprentice and worked with him when he was doing that.
Yeah, and so CNN starts normalizing the behavior, and CNN is seen as, you know, everyone understands that anyone who could ever be swayed understands that Fox News is conservative and that MSNBC tends to be more liberal. But CNN is seen as like the safe place. But the safe place was predisposed to treat Donald Trump without the shock and horror that he deserved.
Okay, and Mike, does that sound about right to you?
Yeah, it's interesting to me to think about how much credit he gets for his media strategy. I think a lot of it was just he deeply enjoys media coverage. I think that's pretty clear at this point from everything we've heard.
It's pathological.
And was willing to do lots of things to get more media coverage and attention that maybe some of the other candidates either weren't willing to do or just weren't able to do because they weren't as interesting to large networks or, you know, print media when it came to the things that they were saying.
Well, Dom, I guess in England, how much of the media coverage, I assume during the GOP race, it was primarily about Trump, because how could it not be? But when it was Trump against Hillary, what percentage of the stories that you were hearing about were just about, oh my God, Trump is one of the nominees versus Hillary is also in there? Because it at least seems possible to me, that Trump was the entire story over there.
Yeah, that was the overwhelming focus, and you'd expect that given that you can only devote so much time to an event that's happening outside your own country and isn't really to the interest of most of the domestic viewers. And so for, you know, when you're thinking about what's going to be involved in that, you're going to look for the most newsworthy stories, the most immediately interesting, and that's always going to be the controversy over whatever stupid or terrible thing Donald Trump said on that particular day.
Scott, I guess I'll go back to you, because I think, do you feel like Hillary did something wrong here in her campaign? You mentioned strategy being the key to Trump's campaign. Did Hillary misplay her campaign?
Yeah, this is a perilously close election. I mean, it's, you know, if you had a vote in the Senate, let's say, that went 50-49, right? Any of the senators in the majority, any one of the 50, could have changed their vote and changed the outcome. So you could say, like, any one of the 50, the majority of the voters in that case were key to the outcome. So in this case, yeah, like, obviously the stuff that the GOP did was essential. The stuff Trump's people did was essential. But yeah, you take out any one of any number of Hillary's mistakes, and that could have tipped it the other way as well.
And Mike, if you can expand on that, because I imagine this is a topic where between the three of us or the four of us, we're going to have some pretty strong disagreements, I think.
Sure. So I went for a walk yesterday with a couple of Clinton staffers because I live down the block from Clinton headquarters in Brooklyn. And I think in retrospect, there are lots of things we would point to, some of which were obvious at the time, even within the campaign, from people who pointed them out and said, like, why aren't we doing more of this? I think the obvious one now in particular is she didn't really have much of a message for working class white folks, the types of folks who ended up throwing the election to Donald Trump and to on whom he focused most of his energy. So if you lived in Michigan or Wisconsin, where it's genuinely true that there are fewer jobs in part as a direct result of the trade agreements that her husband negotiated, like NAFTA, there wasn't much messaging there. Like, if you look at the state of Wisconsin, the last time Hillary went to the state of Wisconsin for a rally was during the primary, I think a full year ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, didn't
like
I heard, I feel like, about Wisconsin that Trump didn't even have a, like, venue prepared for celebrating winning Wisconsin on election night.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me either. I think he, in general, had a much smaller turnout operation than she did.
Oh, his ground game wasn't even comparable.
Yeah, but it surprises me that, given the sheer number of surrogates she had and her schedule, that she didn't spend enough time in those states. I was in Michigan the weekend before the election, so last weekend, and started to get word that not only was Hillary coming in the last week, but Obama was coming to Ann Arbor, Chelsea and Bill were coming to other parts of the state, like Grand Rapids. And that was one of those indications that it seemed like they were scrambling to catch up or scrambling to do something in a state and wanted to figure out, like, when was the last time they were there? And again, it was months. Like, they just did not spend much time. They didn't see their strategy as targeting and winning over some of these middle and working class white folks who previously were a part of the Obama coalition. And they lost them in huge numbers. They expected instead that they could boost turnout among Latinos, among African Americans, among sort of the demographic changes in the United States. And that ended up being completely wrong. Like, they lost much more of those people. Maybe they would have lost, you know, like the counterfactual here. Maybe if in the absence of pushing hard there, they would have lost them by even more. But it's not like they made up those numbers. If anything, they were much softer than what they were for Obama.
Yeah, it's worth taking a deep dive into that. So we'll get onto that in a second. But first, I want to ask you, based on those conversations you had with the Clinton staffers and the general reaction you've seen from people who are involved in the campaign, what's the diagnosis that they're giving for why they lost? Because at least in the media, it's almost been casting around to blame anyone except Clinton or the Clinton campaign itself.
The campaign messaging is largely around Jim Comey, still the FBI director, who put out his letter. Gosh, what was it? About 2 weeks before the election, put out the first letter.
Right, and then about 36 hours before the vote.
Right. So I think the campaign would say that really hampered their ability to get the message they wanted out in public. And that's true. Like, it clearly had an effect on the polling. I think to Scott's point from earlier, there are so many factors here. So many different things went into it. I do think that the Comey, like the Clinton campaign is saying, I do agree that that was singularly effective. Like, in the absence of that, I think she probably wins. But that's not to say that she couldn't have mitigated that if she'd done a bunch of other things better and if the campaign had done a bunch of other things better.
How much do you guys feel like, as people who would probably have a better memory of it than Dom and I would, because I was certainly alive and in America during the Clinton administration, but Hillary was not much on my radar when I was in, like, elementary and middle school. It does definitely feel to me now, like, though, at this point, the kind of like decades long vilification, I would say, of Hillary Clinton potentially played a role here in this election. Am I crazy for feeling that way? Because it feels to me like just the people that I've talked to have the ones who've had concerns about Hillary have just talked about, they just say, oh, it's the emails, without really knowing so much what that means. They just seem to find her untrustworthy without any kind of, in my view, like substantial reasons to. Is that something that, I guess, Scott, I'll start with you. Would you feel like when she was even back in the first lady position, was she being almost demonized by certain parts of the media?
Yeah, I mean, they finally got her. Like, this is, they finally got her in 2016. They finally finished her off. There was Vince Foster's suicide. She was blamed for that. There's always just like with Hillary, they've come up with these buzzwords, and then they don't do a lot to expand on them. But you'll hear like Travelgate, or you'll hear like Whitewater, and then okay, but where's the actual culpability, you know, for Hillary Clinton there? The same thing with the emails. Like, what? How many people could actually tell you like what the thing is that she did wrong with the emails? There was a great piece on Vox I read recently, kind of laying out like, all she did was like, she was a little lazy, but didn't really do anything wrong or unethical or bad with the emails. But it has been for 30 years now. Like, hey, like she's probably unethical because like I keep hearing murmurs that she's unethical. Like my own parents feel that way. When I talk to them about the election, they're like, yeah, but like she's got so much stuff in her history. I'm like, well, could you name one thing? No.
Right. Right. Dom, in England, what is the, you know, when she gets what little media time she gets compared to Donald potentially in England, what is the perception of her over there?
Yeah, let's not just turn this into what's going on over in England, because the answer is not very much at the moment.
No, but just out of curiosity, what's the media?
So it's mostly invoked as a reason to explain why her poll numbers are slipping or why certain shifts are happening, as opposed to examining what the actual controversy is about. I do find it interesting that, so Hillary has been in the public eye for 30 years now, and you consider Arkansas as closer to 40. And her popularity, so coming into like the 2008 election cycle back in, say, mid-2006, she was very popular, looked like she was going to take it pretty easily. And then again in like 2013, 2014, coming off despite all the kind of Benghazi controversy and so on, she had pretty astonishing approval numbers as Secretary of State. And again, it looked like if she ran for the nomination, she would pretty much receive it and then waltz to an easy victory in the general. And it seems like her popularity, more so than almost any other politician's, is highly variable in the sense that whenever she's received this kind of sustained focus, it shifts very strongly in one direction or the other.
And I think part of that is her campaigning style. Like, as much as she is clearly qualified in terms of prior work experience, when it comes to if you put her on the spot and ask her a question about something that's at all challenging for her to answer, I think her instinct is to give a relatively technical answer that, while likely technically true, comes off as a bit misleading or not giving the entire picture. Like, she speaks like a lawyer on the campaign trail, which is probably the exact opposite of how Donald Trump speaks. So when she gets different potential scandals or mini scandals or anything thrown at her, she gives them all the same worth in how she responds to them. Like, she treats them all seriously, and because of that, I think other people treat them seriously as well. So she's not that strong at deflecting scandals, real or imagined.
Yeah, the point about speaking styles is an interesting one. There was an article I saw recently that from a linguistics professor analyzing their different speaking styles, and they said that Donald Trump, despite his kind of personality and campaign being like this avatar of masculinity, he actually has a very feminine speaking style in terms of just the way he constructs sentences, the way he conveys himself, and so on. And that speaking style tends to resonate better with people who aren't already in your base of support. Whereas Hillary, as you said, is very kind of analytic. It's as if she was at a Senate hearing constantly.
Well, Hillary is not like a politician through and through, right? She's good at the governance side of it, and she's good on policy, and she's someone you'd want in your corner if you had a fight. But she got put in the position to run for high office because of her prominence when her husband was president. I mean, Bill is the natural politician. Bill's the one who, you know, could sell the ketchup popsicle to the woman in white gloves. She was just there, and she was super competent and talented. In a visible place, which put her in position to where her inability to connect with people wound up mattering.
Let's get into these postmortems about why Clinton lost and what we can learn moving forward from that. Because Mike alluded to this argument that it was all about her failure to connect with white working class voters, specifically in the Rust Belt states, which are effectively swing states in this election. And one of the big debates in the media narrative at the moment is whether that argument actually has merit or not. Because there are some people who want to put it primarily down to racism or sexism, or to come up with some other explanation for why she lost. So could you get into that argument in particular and why you think that explanation has primacy over any of the others?
I don't know the connecting with the white working class voters.
Yeah.
I think just because if I look at, where was it very close, and where was there an opportunity to make sort of an immediate difference that would have swung the election? That's a clear indicator. So something like 100,000 voters across Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio swung those states to Donald Trump. And you could clearly – you can construct a narrative around almost any strategy she could have done or couldn't have done. But to me, that seems like a pretty clear one that was glaring even at the time. There are articles, if you go back, that point to internal dissension in the campaign because Bill Clinton wanted them to spend more time focusing on the white working class. He felt like that was something where they could actually make a strong case, but strategically they hadn't chosen to go in that direction. And if you just looking at the numbers, that swing, what's required there is pretty small. If they had invested in advertising in those places even, there was a stat that came out yesterday that they spent something like 10 times as much, or they ran 10 times as many ads in the Los Angeles media market as they did in some of these Midwestern state media markets. Something like that to me just seems off.
That's a really bad mistake.
And specifically, they pumped this advertising money into swing states, but it wasn't the swing states which had a chance of being the tipping point state, if that makes sense. So it wasn't in states which had a chance of being the vote that pushed out over 270, the state which was going to decide the election. And so it makes sense if you're aiming for a victory of, let's say, 310 electoral votes, but not if you're aiming to just get over the line. And obviously your primary focus has to be on just winning in the first place, as opposed to kind of running up the score after you've already won.
Right. And so there's this term that gets thrown around a lot, which is to say, in the Electoral College, you have firewall states, sort of your last line of defense. And the reasons that is there is not because it's impenetrable. It's because you know that you have to protect that above all else if you want to survive the fire. And looking back, I didn't know this at the time, but now looking back, it doesn't seem like there was enough protection of the firewall.
Well, the thing that the most overwhelming stat to me in just seeing the demographics and how they voted, not just white working class people in the Midwestern swing states, white women voted majority for Trump. I've seen between 52% and 54%. I think the final number is now 54% of white female voters ended up voting for Trump over Hillary, which to me just blows my mind based on, I know obviously here I am, middle-class white guy, obvious Hillary supporter versus Trump, and it's not a surprise to hear me say this, but it seems crazy to me that he ended up getting more white women than not voting his direction. Scott, how do you think that ended up happening?
It's really crazy because you see this factor of Trump keeps his mouth shut for 2 weeks before the election, and people just forget all the bad stuff. I mean, it's what have you done for me lately? What's the last thing I've heard? Oh, he's been quiet for 2 weeks. There's no controversy. Maybe I can get away with voting for him now. That's such a huge factor, and I was surprised to see it be so, that people were so willing to just forgive and forget after 2 weeks. You figure if the Access Hollywood tape drops towards the very end instead of a month ahead, that probably is not escapable, the later it comes. Or if one of those Apprentice tapes had come out where allegedly Trump had used the N-word, that these are things that could have broken that stretch of days where Trump hadn't done anything to shoot himself in the foot. But I think that's a huge part of it, is that they I've heard the phrase come home. These voters came home. They're Republicans, and they wound up voting Republican. And there just wasn't anything fresh enough or new enough or different enough. It was just – Trump's behavior was so normalized at that point. Oh, that's just how he is. That's the way people behave. And so they cast their ballot for Trump.
Yeah, there was a good line I heard that the people analyzing Trump tend to take him literally but not take him seriously, whereas most of the voters making up their mind, they take him seriously. They want to evaluate him as a candidate, but they don't take him literally. So when he's saying, but you know, when he gets caught on tape saying these things, they're not thinking, oh, he literally wants to grope me, he holds these views. They're thinking, oh, his personality-wise, he's rough around the edges, but they don't translate that into, therefore, he is a terrible person or undeserving of my support in a way that it seems like the kind of detached, dispassionate analysis seems to suggest that he would.
Go ahead.
Well, I also just keep trying to put this in perspective around numbers, because it's hard to imagine, like you're saying. Like, there are these demographic groups that he directly targeted in some of his weirder scandals and weirder statements. If you look at the numbers, right, so once this is all said and done, slightly under half of the voters will have voted for him. Maybe it's 47%, 48%, something like that, which reflects about, when you consider the fact that half of eligible voters just didn't vote at all, like 24% of eligible voters will have voted for him. And it's true. He pulled in a lot of classic Republican voters because it's not like turnout in this election was much, much worse than turnout in other elections. But it also kind of comes down to the fact that there were lots of people who previously voted for Democrats, some of whom switched to Donald Trump, but a lot of whom switched to not voting or just voting but not voting for the president.
Right. Trump got 2 million fewer votes than Mitt Romney did last time, but Hillary just did that much worse than Obama.
Right. She got five or six million fewer votes.
Right.
There was some stat that in Michigan, there were about 100,000 voters who voted down ballot but didn't vote for president. And if those people had voted in the margins that you would expect for Hillary, then she takes Michigan and it's a whole new ballgame. So I think that's a larger focus that we can get into talking about of why Hillary as a candidate specifically failed, and also the kind of broader factors underlying Trump. Because one counter-argument that gets made, and I'm curious how you guys respond to this, is the whole thing that it's about economic anxiety doesn't really hold water when you consider that the lowest income group still pretty solidly broke in favor of Hillary Clinton, as they have done for the Democrats in almost every presidential and national election.
Yeah, there was a study that I saw yesterday that points to, if you affirmatively tell white voters before they vote that they're going to be a minority group soon, and some of these phrases that they test, that it makes them much more likely to say that they're going to support Donald Trump or something like that. So, like, I don't doubt that economic anxiety is a part of it, especially for these regions that were hardest hit by job losses. And I think there have been some counter arguments to say that those regions were also the ones that have seen the biggest job growth under the Obama administration, which is probably true. But it is also true that they are just missing a lot of jobs in those places that were previously there. Lots of people have stopped looking for work. There's a big opiate addiction problem in a lot of these parts of the country. And in total, they heard a message from Trump that was just more appealing, more relevant to them than what they heard from the Clinton campaign. So part of it was economic anxiety. Part of it was anxiety about some of these other factors about what they see as their identity and it mattering in the political system. But I don't completely discount the economic piece. While I know it's not the entirety of the story.
Right. It's strange to me to see kind of Democratic commentators who have tried to shift the focus away from class towards a kind of broader center-left identity politics, now focusing specifically on classes to try and explain away that. So we see things like, oh, well, people earning under 50,000 a year voted for Hillary, therefore class can't be an explanation. When you consider things like, well, that group overwhelmingly includes students who are a big part of Democratic support, but obviously don't have an independent income. We talk about household income, but that's not really a useful metric either. And also, like, you'd expect the Democrats to win with those groups. If it's even up for discussion whether they did, then there is a serious problem. And the fact that your natural constituency feels that you're failing to represent them is a big warning sign, not just for this election, but going forward too. And also, that there are stats that, like, oh, well, Trump voters earn more than the national average and so on. Firstly, all voters earn more than the national average. That includes Clinton voters, it includes Sanders voters, and the very poorest in society by and large just don't vote, and that's part of the turnout issue. And I think also, finally, there's a difference between being young and in a job that doesn't pay much versus being a lot older in a job which maybe pays a bit more, but which you've had for years, this is the most you're ever going to earn. And if that job goes away, which a lot of them will do, then you really just have no other option. And if that job is in some area which defines your community as a whole, then it ties into wider cultural issues and so on. So to me, kind of brushing that away by saying, oh, well, look at this graph where low-income voters voted for Hillary just kind of fundamentally misses the point.
I think that's a great point. And I'd add to one other thing to it, which is to say, it's also different to say that you might be in a job that pays you, you know, X dollars above the national average. But what if 10, 15 years ago you had a job that actually paid you quite a bit more and your salary has now gone down and is relatively plateaued? And I can happily talk about the extent to which this relates to healthcare. But what if you're now paying much more for health insurance and a lot of that is cutting away from, even if you see it in the money that you pay, you know, from out of your own pocket for healthcare expenses, there's also a part of it that you know is there that your employer is paying more for it and they're not giving you a raise anymore because healthcare is so expensive.
Right.
So all of those factors are real.
I'd also point out that those stats tend to be weighted by like the lawyer who has voted Republican in every election for the past 30 years. And obviously, if he's only 100,000 a year, that's going to drive the average up. That doesn't say anything about the specific areas and the specific voters who shifted towards Trump in this election, which are primarily those kind of poor rural voters in the Rust Belt states. But Mike, you said you could happily talk about the healthcare side of this. Please do so, because that's your area of expertise and also one of the central issues in the most recent election cycle, I think.
Yeah, so we can talk about what the future implications of it are. But I think one thing to note here, the Comey letter came out around the same time that something else came out, which was a lot of media coverage around what premiums were going to be from Affordable Care Act plans. So let me try to break down parts of this, right? So the Affordable Care Act is Obamacare. It's what everybody has heard of. Obamacare has lots of different components to it. There's a part of it that expanded Medicaid, which is the state-based programs for the poor. Essentially, the standard for what it meant to be poor was raised so that more people qualified and could get that state-based healthcare coverage. That's optional. So some states chose to do it. Actually, the majority of states chose to do it. Some states chose not to. It's a long story. It wasn't supposed to be optional, but the Supreme Court said, guess what? It's optional. So that's a piece of it. That exists. People, by and large, have been pretty happy with that. There's another part of it, which is the health insurance exchanges, which have been much more challenged since the law started. And the idea here is that if you are not quote-unquote poor, so if you're not eligible for the Medicaid exchange or the Medicaid expansion, and you want health insurance but it's not offered through your job, the federal government and some states created these healthcare exchanges where different health insurance companies could offer specific health insurance products that got lots of different evaluations from the federal government to say they had to include X. They had to be priced pretty carefully, and I can talk more about this in detail, but there were specific pricing regulations depending on how old you were, and they couldn't do a lot of things they did previously, like change those prices quite a bit, you know, based on age. They couldn't change them based on your gender, your health status in a lot of different ways, things like that. Lots of things have conspired to the fact that roughly when the Comey letter came out, the James Comey FBI letter, what also came out was the fact that the average premium, so the average sort of monthly fee for health insurance from plans on those health insurance exchanges, which again, they only represent like 8 to 10% of the country who get insurance from them. But for those people, premiums were going up and they were going up a lot. So as opposed to going up by 2% or 8% or something like that, they were going to go up by 22%. And that was the average, and the average hid the fact that there's lots of variation. So in some states, they stayed flat or went down. In some states, they went up crazy amounts, like Arizona is one. But if you were feeling the pain from health insurance going up, that was a pretty visible reminder that it's gotten really expensive in the United States. There's also plenty more to that. So if you're an employee, so even if you get insurance from your employer, you've been paying tons more for your healthcare over the last few years. So healthcare expenses in the United States have gone up maybe, you know, anywhere from 4% to 7% a year. And that's compared to incomes going up and GDP rising by 1% or 2%. So huge gap compared to your earnings going up. And not only does that mean that you then pay more every month in health insurance premiums, or like your subscription fee for your insurance, but you're also now responsible to pay more out of pocket before you get any benefits. So more people have what are called high deductible health plans, which mean they're responsible out of pocket for the first $1,000 they spend on healthcare, or $2,000. Or if you're a family with a plan on the health insurance exchange, maybe $10,000, maybe $14,000. So a ton of money that not only are you spending on this health insurance, which doesn't really buy you very much, but you're spending directly at the doctor because your health insurance is not helping you that much when you actually need something. And that's been a visible thing in politics in the United States for years now, since the Affordable Care Act passed. But that was another area where timing was just, you know, from Hillary Clinton's perspective, terribly unfortunate that it became a topic right at the end of the election.
Well, Trump, obviously no fan of this Obamacare. What is it going to look like, in your opinion, under Trump?
Oh, boy. So that is a great question. I'm just thinking about the fact that we were on a phone call. So for my job, we had a long phone call about, you know, the future. And I think there are some initial perspectives, but the truth is, even still, we have no idea, because Trump never said anything too specific about his healthcare plan. If anything, he said four or five different things and then ended with, we're going to repeal it and we're going to replace it, quote unquote, with something terrific. You're going to love it. It's going to be terrific.
Oh, okay. Never mind then. I'm fine. Right. Don't sweat it.
Exactly.
He knows more about healthcare than the generals do.
That's right. That might be true. I don't know how many, too many generals, other than the Surgeon General, who spent a lot of time thinking about healthcare. Thank you. I appreciate it. There are lots of problems with trying to predict what's going to happen. And I think it can go down a couple of different paths. So if Trump has mended fences with Paul Ryan, Paul Ryan has a repeal and replace Obamacare argument that doesn't have a ton of specifics about what the replacement would look like. It has some typically, you know, GOP-friendly proposals about you'd be able to buy insurance across state lines, some things about changing what benefits are required. So instead of requiring lots of things like birth control, like the current Obamacare plans do, minimizing that list and cutting it down, and then creating a lower cost, higher deductible plan where you'd be responsible to pay more out of pocket if you got health insurance, but the monthly cost would be a lot cheaper. Some things like that are probably going to happen no matter what, but it's going to vary a lot depending on who gets put in charge of what in the United States is called the Department of Health and Human Services, which is our sort of federal healthcare infrastructure. And because this is so opaque right now, it could be almost anyone. So it could be Dr. Ben Carson. It could be Newt Gingrich, who has a strong interest in healthcare. It could be congressional staffers who have worked on other health policy programs. It could be Rick Scott, who used to be the governor of Florida and who ran a massive for-profit hospital company in the United States. It's going to vary a ton. It also could be someone from the pharmaceutical industry. Like Chris Christie has a good friend who used to be the CEO of Celgene, a large pharmaceutical company, and he was in the mix before it turned out that he was closing down bridges for political gain. But it's really hard to predict what's going to happen going forward. I think one thing I feel pretty confident about is that it's not going to get repealed, quote unquote, root and branch, like Ted Cruz described, because that's just not possible at this point without massive disruption. Something like 20 million people in the United States now have health insurance as a result of this program who didn't have it before. The vast majority of those people are from things that are also very popular, like the Medicaid expansion, like if you're under 26 years old, being able to stay on your parents' health insurance plan, things like that. And getting rid of those would be both tremendously disruptive and tremendously unpopular. And things that are both of those things rarely happen in American politics. So I think whoever gets put in charge or whoever has a say in health policy going forward, and it's probably not going to be me because I don't think I've got a lot of sway with the Trump administration when it comes to healthcare, but they're probably going to look first to modify. And I anticipate, unless Donald Trump plans to govern as like a centrist healer and reconciler, that no matter what, it'll be called repealing Obamacare. But that might just be messaging, and it might mostly be a lot of sort of structural and technical reforms to how the program works. to try to make it a little bit more market oriented. So Republicans tend to really like these things called health savings accounts, which are pre-funded bank accounts that can only get used to pay for healthcare expenses. So basically money that you save that you then spend on healthcare and only on healthcare. So there are probably going to be a lot more of those. But other than that, and other than some of these, you know, relatively commonly discussed Republican policies, it's pretty hard to know exactly what's going to happen.
There is a general pattern within all political systems that new entitlements become entrenched and politically untouchable to some degree fairly quickly. So it often becomes about the extent to which those programs are funded or kind of tinkering around the edges rather than repeating them wholesale, despite the best despite the best wishes of the people who might wish to do that. There were reports coming out of Trump's meeting with Obama recently where Trump said he actually has come around on some aspects of Obamacare and he admired the philosophy behind it in general. And understandably, some people were kind of wanting to cling to that as a sign that maybe things won't be so bad and that Trump himself might be able to moderate while in office. I think the issue, though, is by all reports, Trump is someone who just becomes attracted to whichever superficially appealing idea he most recently heard. And the people who that he's going to be employing to be those voices in his ear are the kind of typical Republican administrators that would be starving his entire government. And then also, even if Trump himself turns out to be somehow better than expected, you have Republicans controlling both the House and the Senate. You have Supreme Court nominations on which Trump has strongly indicated that he's going to appease like the far-right Christian conservatives. And then also at all levels of state and local government as well, the Republicans are in the ascendant. So even if Trump, like, understandably, the focus has been almost entirely on Trump. But even if Trump ends up not being the end of the world, you're going to have a quote-unquote normal Republican administration, which has its own issues to worry about.
Well, quickly, I think it would be hard for Trump to be worse than a lot of us are expecting.
Sure, but
he's trying. It looks like at the time we're recording this, it looks like he might make Stephen Bannon his chief of staff, which is like the number one job he's going to have to pick. And Bannon is an admirer of certain German philosophies of
that. That doesn't sound good.
Well, I think that's really interesting if he goes that way. So, and sorry to interrupt, we can come back to
in
general. But think about this, right? So as of yesterday, there were sort of two leading choices for chief of staff. There was Reince Priebus, who famously to me is, as Stephen Colbert described him, the sound Bill Cosby makes when getting out of a chair.
I've never once seen his name written that my first instinct wasn't, well, that's a typo.
So there was either Reince Priebus, who was the head of the Republican National Committee, or there was Steve Bannon, who is the Breitbart CEO. He was the chairman of the Trump campaign. And choosing one instead of the other actually has massive implications about what Trump is planning on doing. Because Reince Priebus from Wisconsin, very close friends with Paul Ryan. I think if you choose Reince Priebus, that suggests that you plan to work very closely with the sort of entrenched Republicans in the House and the Senate. Steve Bannon hates Paul Ryan. I think that is no understatement. He would say it himself, despises Paul Ryan, has written about it, wanted to get him voted out of office. True, deep ideological hatred.
Why?
He sees Paul Ryan as sort of a very typical conservative that hasn't helped anybody in years, has his own preference for people who are much more populist, and has like multiple times funded far right wing challenges to Paul Ryan. I think if Trump chooses Steve Bannon,
did you see the quote that Paul Ryan had this morning about Steve Bannon?
No, what did he say?
He said they asked him, what do you think about Steve Bannon? And Paul Ryan said, "Well, I've never met him, so I presume he's a good guy."
Something like that. Yeah, politicians, honest and complete in their sentences.
Yeah.
My goodness. Well, Steve Bannon, I think, very publicly hates Paul Ryan. If Trump chooses Steve Bannon, the implication of that is that he does not intend to govern like a traditional present-day Republican. I think that would actually be pretty it's an important thing to watch for. If he chooses Steve Bannon, that means something pretty significant.
How likely would you say that is?
So I know he's down to two people from what we've heard from the New York Times.
50-50 then. It's yes or no.
Exactly. Pure survivor math. It's 50-50 right. Based on that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I honestly think it's more likely he goes with Bannon because Bannon has been more in his inner circle, and that's just how Trump operates. Like, he wants the people who have been with him, who have been loyal to him. So As of right now, I would say I think it's more likely it's going to be Bannon.
Yeah, if he goes with his gut, I think it's probably Bannon. If he listens to, as we've heard so many times, if he listens to whatever the last person says to him, it'll end up being Reince Priebus, because everyone else, everyone other than his inner circle, is going to tell him to go with Priebus.
Okay.
Do you think that, in a way, confirms Trump's desire to pick Bannon then? Because there is a certain effect where, like, if everyone else is telling you to do it, they become, like, the establishment voices who are trying to lead you astray, and he can stand up to the consensus, and he can, you know, blaze his own path. And it seems like if anyone was going to deliberately pick a fight in order to get who they want appointed, it would be someone like Trump.
Well, you have to think about, like, motivations, right? There will be people within Trump's, like, so-called inner circle who will prefer Reince Priebus, because Steve Bannon is not a guy who, like, everybody is like, oh, what a sweet, like, I met him, he was so nice, like, he fed my dog when I was out of town. Like, that's not Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon is an asshole. He pisses off, like, everybody he interacts with who he's not sucking up to. But the motivations of the people in Trump's inner circle are pretty clear. Like, if you're Jared Kushner and you want to have a ton of influence over your father-in-law when he's president, then you want the guy who's circling the wagons and who's not going to be shutting you out for whatever Paul Ryan thinks. Like, I think that there are a lot of these strong voices who feel like if they want to remain strong voices, then they need the horrible guy.
And I think my potential counterargument to that would be that it starts with the thesis that Donald Trump, president-elect of the United States, is terrified. He did not expect to win. He now has to actually do this. And that is deeply distressing to him. Somebody who has been the quote-unquote chairman of this company, his own company, for years. evidently, he works long hours, but he doesn't really do anything for the company other than fly around, put on hats, shake hands, say things that are barely rooted in evidence, facts, or common sense, and then fly back to Trump Tower. So if he now has to be president of the United States, he's going to want someone who can do the work for him. And he's going to want other people to listen to him. Just from those perspectives, it makes me think that he's going to give Pence a lot of authority and then would theoretically also give, you know, whoever his chief of staff is a lot of authority. And he would want those people to have good relationships to actually get things done. Because if it relies on him working hard and staying in Washington on the weekends, for example, he doesn't seem like he wants to do that.
Yeah, I mean, he's always struck me, certainly during this campaign at least, as a guy who has understood that at least for him and his business, it seems, that there has so far been no such thing as bad publicity. And certainly as his numbers continued to grow, I think he continued to feel stronger and stronger about that. But I had also certainly pondered the idea that maybe he didn't even want to win the presidential election and just wanted a ton of free publicity for the Trump brand. Do you think there actually is something to that, Mike? Or do you think he genuinely did feel like, oh, this country needs me to take it by the horns, to use it, you know, grab the bull by the horns, to use a more friendly than Trump expression about it?
Yeah, he would have described it slightly differently.
Yeah.
So here's what I think is definitely true. I think in the last month, he was convinced he was not going to win. And I think that he probably was a little bit relaxed about that. I think there was a time in this when he got into it because he said, like, damn it, I'm going to be the president. I will genuinely do great at this because I'm great at everything. I'm a winner. Nothing I do ever fails. I've never failed at anything. I'll be fantastic. And I'll stick it to Barack Obama and Seth Meyers and all those people who made fun of me at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2011. So I think that there's a part of him that does feel that way. But I also think that in the last month, he probably talked himself up to say, like, oh, boy, thank God I don't actually have to be the president because it's really hard and I'm exhausted from campaigning. And it sounds like being the president is not notably easier than running this campaign this entire time. So I'm really excited to go back home to Trump Tower to start my, you know, media company or write a book or whatever he was going to do and generally take it easy for a while.
Right. I was terrified he was going to get to just have Trump TV take off and be a national phenomenon where he would just get to sit in Monday morning quarterback everything and talk about how great it would all be if he had been elected and how he would have done it all perfectly.
And I think he was really excited about that.
Yeah, that would have been really, really – thank God we avoided that timeline, huh?
But now we get this official propaganda channel from the White House. It's like FDR's Fireside Chats for a New Generation. But Mike, you alluded to the role of Mike Pence, and this is something which has certainly gone understated in all of the international coverage of this, but also in the domestic coverage too. Trump is like this blustering figurehead and obviously will have the final say of what happens. But if if Pence ends up being like this Dick Cheney figure, that is the darkest timeline potentially, because Pence, Trump is terrifying in his own way, but Pence is, you know, Pence can do a much better job, I think, of marshalling like Republican legislators, and he wouldn't really face any real opposition, and his agenda is more terrifying in a lot of ways than Trump's could ever hope to be. So Mike Pence being the de facto president is the scariest outcome, and one which has received less attention than it ought to, probably.
Mike and I have actually talked a bit about this, and I've vacillated on like what's worse. You know, is it worse to have someone like Mike Pence in charge who can enact all the Republicans' wet dreams, or is it worse to have Donald Trump, who is a crazy person who has expressed an affinity for launching nuclear weapons and is buddy-buddy with Russia? And I just think, like, I'll take the devil I know. You know, I think I've settled on, like, give me Mike Pence. I know the damage he can do, and I know it's not going to blow up the world. So give me not blowing up the world. I'll take that for 4 years, and then we can work on trying to undo all the horrible things that he does. But Trump is capable of things that we can't undo.
The thing is, I've been doing similar. I've certainly wondered myself which would be worse, Trump, or might it actually be Mike Pence? And my thought was, Trump, I think you were totally right that the, I'm going to say the word upside, meaning like the disaster upside, like the consequences could be certainly much more extreme if Trump, gets out of line, I guess, in the Oval Office. But I feel like as much as Trump will likely be a disaster in many ways, the super, super, super disaster timelines are very unlikely to come in. Like literally the world ending, I think, is in play, but extremely unlikely, all things considered. Whereas with Pence, if he were to, you know, if he is just the shadow president, or if Trump were to get impeached for whatever reason and he were to become literally the president, I feel like every single time a Mike Pence administration is going to do, you know, set the country back 100 years, which to me is worse.
Well, look, here's some of the stuff that, like, that Trump could do that isn't pressing the button to launch the nukes, but is still horrible.
Okay.
You know, if he disrupts all these trade agreements, he pulls us out of NATO, and America is no longer backing up Western Europe as Putin tries to expand Russia, that's a pretty horrible scenario. So,
well, I was told we got ripped off in all these deals, Scott.
Yeah, no, you're going to get a great new deal. It's going to be
deal?
The best new deal. Yeah, forget that FDR stuff. Like, this is the best new deal. So I don't think that like a Pence or Mike and I have talked, like, what if it had just been like Rubio or one of those sort of empty suit Republicans from the primary getting through? You know, they're going to do stuff that is bad, and especially domestically. You know, they're going to restrict civil rights and they're going to screw up the economy, you know, tax cuts for the wealthy, and they're gonna end social services, and that stuff is all bad. A lot of it is reversible ultimately. It's very bad, but I don't think that they're gonna pull us out of our international alliances, and I don't think they're going to just sit idly by as Putin continues the aggression streak he's been on for the last couple of years. But Trump has shown a dangerous commitment to not challenging Russia and to not challenging Putin and to not even listening to any potentially negative facts about Putin, not to mention all the conflicts of interest that are tied into all of that. So I think you have to take the devil you know. You got to, if you had a choice, I think you have to take the Mike Pence thing and just know that at least a lot of that stuff you can dig yourself out of it if you get a fair election in 4 years.
Yeah, and so one of the reasons Scott and I have spoken about this so much is because I think we disagree about it pretty strongly. And to avoid me being a pundit, right? Like, I truly don't know. I have no idea how Donald Trump would govern. I do feel like
neither does he. Point, so you're in good territory.
Exactly. To the points you guys have made, like it is pretty clear to me how Mike Pence would govern if he had his way. And the optimist in me wants to think that Donald Trump, guy who was a New York born and raised Democrat until a couple of years ago, is likely to do things that I personally would want to see happen, like infrastructure spending. He'll have some U.S. trade rights. Like, he's not actually personally going to go negotiate deals. Like, he's not going to go, you know,
I think he thinks he is.
Yeah, I don't think he knows that there's a U.S. trade representative that does a job at somebody.
They're going to put him on the phone with Kate McKinnon doing her angry voice, and then they'll, like, something out, and then he'll go to sleep in Trump Tower, and he'll never know the difference.
Yeah,
Kate McKinnon's busy pretending to be Hillary, so that could be a fun, like, rerun election in 4 years. But, yeah, so my issue with that kind of line of argument is, So let's say infrastructure spending, for instance. It may be that Donald Trump favors greater infrastructure spending, but it's going to be on the same terms that he has been pursuing construction projects for the past 40 years, which is hideously corrupt, willing to trample over anyone who's going to stand in his way, not paying his workers properly, not paying his contractors properly. Like, in very broad terms, it might be the same kind of idea, but the actual implementation of it might be catastrophic.
Yeah, I can only imagine that for it to actually pass. So he now has almost complete control over the Republican Party, right? So when I think about that, I think if he starts going after Republican members of Congress who don't want to do what he wants, he can very easily get them primaried, cause them a lot of trouble in their districts. So I imagine that if he decides that there's something that actually matters to him that he wants to do, he has pretty strong authority to get it done. But it does still have to go through Congress. Like, it has to be proposed in a bill from Congress and work its way through. So, and again, this is me who – I'm an optimist by nature. I imagine that if he chooses to do some of those things, that they'll happen in a way that, you know, is less, as has been reported, shady than how he does construction in his personal company.
Why would we – I mean, at least for me, who is – I am generally probably not an optimist, but at least for me, I just feel like I have no reason to believe that he would behave that way. I feel like all we've seen repeatedly from him, at least, is that he's willing to do it the way that Dom has described it, like just completely hose the people who have been working for him and the contractors and everything just to maximize the profit for himself.
I don't know how the federal government could do that as policy, though. Like, could he pass a law that pays people and then pass another law that says retroactively we're taking the money away from all those people?
I don't know. More generally, I just am I am terrified, I suppose, that I've never seen anything from Donald Trump that does not blatantly indicate to me that the Trump brand is his number one priority above everything.
And yeah, also, I don't think like Donald Trump would be wearing a hard hat personally supervising these construction projects. My issue would be the corruption that naturally flocks to that kind of project. He's not going to be in any kind of mind to supervise. And if anything, he's going to be enabling it if he thinks it's going to be for his own personal gain.
But it's going to be like the construction in Iraq and Afghanistan, you're saying, essentially, where we hired subcontractors to subcontractors to subcontractors and money disappeared and buildings were built that had to get torn down and they were structurally unstable because no one was really watching.
Right, and you had Paul Bremer being put in charge, who knew nothing about the situation, but like was not being kept in check by the Bush administration. So things like that. And my issue is with this debate, I think like Pence is going to be would be terrible within the boundaries of what we've come to expect, which is a worrying thought in itself. But if Pence is able to get the entire Republican congressional delegation behind him, which it seems fairly realistic, like he's going to be a lot better at doing that than Trump would be, I think. Then he can move the Overton window so far to the right that it would go on to just incredibly scary territory. Whereas Trump, I think the hope is going to be that some kind of gridlock will result from internal struggles within the Republican Party. Like if he goes to war with Paul Ryan, if there are like the ever decreasing band of never Trump Republicans actually do take a stand against him, then maybe there can be some kind of shutdown there. But with Pence, I think it is just going to be like pure Republican hegemony for the next 4 years at least. And that's a scarier thought to me.
Well, at least 2 years. I mean, ostensibly in 2 years, the House of Representatives could flip. It happens a lot when you get a new president from a new party. The trend has been that 2 years later, there's a massive change in Congress. We had that in 2010, right,
with
the Tea Party that kind of came through. And then in 2002, the Democrats took I can't remember. That was after 9/11. Yeah. But 94, 2 years after Clinton was elected, you had the Republican Revolution and Newt Gingrich taking over Speaker of the House. So it feels, you know, just like it felt a week ago, like the Democrats were never going to lose the White House ever again to some people. It sort of feels now like the Democrats could never retake the Congress, but it's just not true. And in 2 years, it could suddenly be very, very hard for Donald Trump or Mike Pence to pass legislation.
Let's talk about that, because right now you have a Republican triple lock over all branches of government. That is a very unusual state of affairs. It's only happened, I think, twice since in the 20th century. And we can expect at some point that's going to be, if not overturned completely, then at least challenged to some degree. But I think you think back to like 2012 after Obama won re-election, there was all of this talk of this permanent realignment that the Republicans were doomed based on demographics. You know, Texas would be going blue eventually, and the Republicans would be reduced to like the party of white voters, which, first of all, if you actually look at the electoral math, is not a bad place to be, at least in the short term. But secondly, that doesn't seem to be happening. And so when we talk about the broader implications of this, you know, looking ahead to the midterms in 2 years and then even further ahead still, where do you think the Democrats have to go from here? Where do you think they will go?
I disagree. I think it is happening. It just doesn't happen immediately. You know, you don't flip Texas over a span of 4 years, but the trend is that you're getting more immigrants, more voters of Latino origin, and you know that is happening. It's just not happening fast enough for the Republicans to be shut out of office. And you have to remember also, not 100% of these people are going to vote for the Democrats. They just are majority Democrat voters, so that slows it even more.
Right, but so based on current trends, the stat I saw was if the Republicans lose the non-white vote and continue gaining the white vote, then they will have a hold on the Electoral College until sometime in like the mid-2040s, which obviously events will overtake that, and there will be elections which they lose because that's the natural political pendulum. But I think this idea that the Democrats have inevitability and it's only a matter of time, it's maybe a comforting thought, but you know, how many decades of Republicans winning the White House do you have to endure before you start kind of looking for a new perspective and a more immediate future?
But it's not either or, because the map was less friendly to Democrats 4 and 8 years ago, and you had Obama come through and take all those electoral votes. So it's not like it's impossible. I mean, part of it is you need a great candidate, right? Barack Obama was like a generationally talented candidate. Bill Clinton was a generationally talented candidate. These are politicians who really connect with people and are great on the campaign trail. There's very few of those. I mean, you had a field of what, like 3,412 Republicans running for president this cycle, and none of the actual politicians had that. None of the actual politicians had that. You didn't have it 4 years ago with Mitt Romney. You didn't have it 8 years ago with John McCain. McCain maybe had it in 2000 when he ran against George Bush, but it's really hard to find a talent like that. So part of it is also looking at the bench and seeing who could be the next person who can connect with voters, and then it all comes back fast.
Yeah, and look, to tie those last two comments together there, the bench and sort of the electoral map, Democrats are we're in red alert territory right now. It's bad. You can look at some of the things down ballot. So I think Democrats for years have convinced themselves, ourselves, that because we have this demographic hold on the presidency, the other stuff just is going to matter less. Republicans did not convince themselves of that. So Republicans have made tremendous efforts to run candidates in, you know, virtually every district. They have a dominant hold on governorships in the country. So they have 33 governorships. I think that might be up to 35 by now once the votes are all counted. They control nearly 2/3 of state legislatures in the United States, which they're one state away from being able to offer up and vote on amendments to the Constitution with just the number of state legislatures that they hold.
Just to jump in, there are a total of four states which have a Democratic governor and legislature at the moment. Four.
Right.
And there's no reason to think that's going up anytime soon.
So Democrats have been like woefully deficient at managing these non-presidential races. So obviously, right, they don't control the House. Obviously, they don't control the Senate. But everything else looks worse. And that really – so it matters now because – A, they have to fight like hell to make sure that they hold enough state legislatures to not allow amendments to the Constitution. It's shocking that we even have to talk about that because it's so close. They need to field real candidates at all levels of elected office. They need to have an actual full-time chairman of the party. So for years, the Democrats have had this as a part-time position that's held by an elected official, whereas the Republicans have had full-time people who do the job, and the Democrats just haven't done that. I don't know why.
And that's, to me as an outsider, that just seems mind-boggling. Like, this is the most important institutional role in your party structure, and you're not going to hire one person to fill it properly?
Right, you're one of two parties.
It's mind-boggling to me, too. And there's also been like just tremendous variation in strategy from one administration to another. So there is not a coherent, consistent strategy about how we're going to attack down-ballot races. The last time there was a strategy to run candidates in essentially all states was when Howard Dean was chairman of the DNC. It was called, appropriately enough, the 50-state strategy. And it was ridiculed as if this was a ridiculous idea to run candidates in these races where they were unlikely to be competitive. And to me, that's nuts, because obviously you have to run those races both to divert resources from your opponents and to introduce these ideas in places where they're otherwise not getting a fair hearing. So we need a very strong move towards another 50-state strategy, and we desperately need to retake these state legislatures, these governorships, before the next census. Because when the census happens is when redistricting happens, which is another crazy thing that happens in the United States political system, which is to say, literally, you get to draw the shape of what congressional districts are going to look like, so the regions that elect people to the House of Representatives. And you can draw them crazily as long as they are continuous. So as long as they don't split into different areas, you can draw them however you want. So what typically gets happened is that you draw lots and lots and lots of districts, if you're a Republican, that have a small minority of Democrats in them so that they're very safe Republican seats. And then you just draw a few relatively large districts that are all Democrats so that you have housed the Democrats all in a smaller number of districts in your area. That's what's happened. That was an intentional strategy that's been very successful from the Republicans. The Democrats do nothing about that and need to do something about it if they ever want to have a chance of controlling the House of Representatives again.
Yeah, this is something I've talked about before the election even. I've been telling people, like, hey, the potential possible maybe like silver lining to the cloud if Trump does win, and of course that wasn't going to happen. He wasn't going to win, so it didn't really matter. But the silver lining was that perhaps he gets elected and he's horrible and he's hated and he's so bad that the Democrats can take some of these state houses back and they can be in charge when the census comes up for redistricting, because 2020 is, I believe, the election that's going to decide who's in those state houses at that time. So if people are coming out in droves to vote out Donald Trump, which I think is still very much in play, that's going to have a down ballot effect that could help the Democrats, despite all their strategic deficiencies, to be in position to redraw a lot more of those maps this time around.
And that process plays on a natural weakness of Democrats and of center-left parties more widely, which is if you're piling up vote within these cities, which tend to be districted in a certain way, that doesn't actually help you with the popular vote. And so it doesn't help you with the electoral college vote. So, you know, the point that you made, Scott, about, well, if over time demographics change, and so if, let's say, there are a lot more Hispanic voters, well, if those just pile up in the same districts in California, that's not actually going to change the arithmetic at all.
Right.
I've spent my whole life feeling like, not really knowing concrete reasons, but just feeling, just watching elections play out, like Democrats aren't even competitive with Republicans when it comes to campaigning. And now I feel like I've been underselling just how bad they have been by comparison, hearing from you guys more about this.
Most people in the country want to vote for Democrats for stuff. I mean, that there are more people vote Democrats at like all levels than Republicans, but the Republicans are just so good at making sure that their votes matter more.
Or that the Democrats just don't get to cast their votes. You look at voter suppression efforts over the past few decades, and particularly like in this cycle, there's a lot of talk about Wisconsin, North right. Carolina, and that's something that has to be resisted on a state and federal level.
For southern states, you see the effects of the Voting Rights Act being dismantled right. by the Supreme Court. And of course, that didn't apply to Wisconsin. Wisconsin went ahead and did its thing on its own. But yeah, this is a big problem, and the counter strategy is to use the same laws for the Democrats to use the same laws to litigate Republican registrations.
Yeah. Like I have very no strong track. Feelings about the failure of the Democratic Party to defend these things. So like here's a quick case study, right? So look at Nevada and look at Wisconsin. There are many differences demographically in those two states, but I think there's one important difference to focus on, which is that Nevada has extraordinarily strong unions. They have the culinary union, which essentially runs the casino industry in most of Nevada. Whereas Wisconsin, when Scott Walker, the current governor, took over, he passed sweeping legislation that essentially destroyed unions in the state of Wisconsin. And the Democrats protested. There were lots of protests. They haven't done anything to fix it. You know, one thing that could have happened is when the Obama administration started, and this was discussed, the Obama administration could have passed what was called Card Check, which was essentially a pretty far-reaching pro-union piece of legislation that would make it easier for unions to form and be stable entities. And like, from a political perspective, it was malpractice not to do that. You can also make the case that for a workers' rights perspective, it was malpractice not to do that because unions, you can say many negative things about unions, but they also tend to, you know, preserve wages, protect collectively bargained rights, et cetera, et cetera. And their destruction, along with things like the end of the Voting Rights Act in large parts of the country, has been tremendously negative for democratic prospects in those parts. So it's true. Like, there are lots of structural factors that make it harder for Democrats to win elections at any level. Like, Democrats won clearly here the majority of the popular vote, but again, concentrated in a few states. They also, in many elections, win the majority of votes for House races. And don't come anywhere near a majority because of how districts are structured. So Republicans have been tremendously effective at structuring the system in such a way that makes it hard for Democrats to take control, which, if anything, shows you how impressive it was that Barack Obama, when he did win, won with the presidency, 60 seats in the Senate, and a majority of the House, because structurally everything was against him. And it makes it even more frustrating that when that happened, that the Democrats didn't get more done to sort of undo some of those changes that have made them structurally deficient in competing.
Sure. And you can tie this into the other arguments that are being made here as well. So you look in Nevada, where in most states in the country, that the trend is white men tend to vote Republican in greater numbers. In Nevada, that trend is reversed, right? And that's one state where that's held up. And you can debate how much that's due to union representation, whether it's a kind of chicken or egg style thing. But either way, that's a trend that has to be noticed. And more broadly speaking, going back to the political realignment point, a lot of the realignments that people tend to speak about in the past it often ends up being like this very simplistic treatment of what's going on. So you think about like 1964, Lyndon Johnson, Great Society, the Civil Rights Act, and so on. That's hailed as the start of this permanent shift. But you look back, that actually occurred much before that, in the 50s, and then going back even to the tail end of the New Deal, and then 1968, the Southern Strategy, and then Reagan in 1980. Again, those factors were in play a long time before. So the idea that any kind of the realignment is going to come soon or be permanent is wishful thinking. And so you need to be out there looking at this now. And if your votes in the cities are going to be piled up and count for less on average, then that makes it even more important that you need to reach out to those white working class voters who made up about a third of the Obama coalition. So, it's a much wider discussion to be had there.
Yeah, it's not. So taking back state houses is really, really tough. Taking back Congress is the House of Representatives in 2 years is a lot more doable because you'd have to take a number of seats that's pretty standard to take when the House flips. You're not trying to retake like 100 seats. It's something like what, 25, Mike, something like that.
I think that sounds about right. I don't remember the number.
It's something very doable. I mean, for all the hard work the Republicans have put in letting themselves have a majority with a minority of the votes cast, there are limits to it, and it's not a firewall for them. It's happened within the last 10 years. The Democrats have had both houses, so if the Republicans start really getting their way, like, be careful what you wish for, because you're going to wind up upsetting and hurting a lot of these same voters who were so taken by Trump's message.
I think that may be – I guess the argument is that could understate the extent of the problem. So you think about the Reagan Revolution, where Reagan sweeps to power, wins the vast majority of the electoral vote and the popular vote. It looks like that's going to be an overwhelming victory for Republicans, but they still fail to capture the House for quite some time. Same thing with Nixon in 68 and 72. And so the fact that Trump was able to, and I'm not sure how much of it is riding on Trump's coattails, but the fact that all of this is aligned to give the Republicans like the triple lock over of the government, that is, it's not unprecedented, but it's lacking precedent in a way which should be quite scary.
Well, one of probably my biggest question about this entire thing, this whole just election and all of this fallout, is how did no one see this coming? It seemed like, or virtually no one, it seems like all of the most accredited pollsters, like the Nate Silvers and everyone else of the world, were very high on Hillary throughout. I know Nate in particular started leaning, at least opening a lot more of the doors for uncertainty and saying, hey, look, there's plenty that could go the other way. But it seemed like it genuinely took all of the country that was, at least certainly all of the country that was hoping for Hillary, took that side of the country completely by surprise. How did that happen? It seems that were people just not wanting to admit that they were voting for Trump, or what was it?
Yeah, well, so there's this amazing clip from about June of 2015 where Keith Ellison is on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. And he says, like, you know, we got to be careful. Donald Trump, he's popular with people. He could be the nominee. He, you know, we don't want to be looking back a year from now and say he's going to be the next president. And everyone laughs him out of the room. Like, even George Stephanopoulos, every other commentator is like, you don't actually believe that, do you? So I think they're – like there have been many claims of arrogance, but there was some actual arrogance here to think there's no way that could happen. So we're not even going to plan for that as a possible outcome.
Well, for me, though, Nate Silver has no motivation but to get it right.
Well, no, he has a motivation to promote his brand, and that's aligned with getting it right, but there are other things going on. But going back to that Keith Ellison clip, even over in the Upside Down, you had Ann Coulter. There was a clip of her saying, I think the most scary candidate from an electoral perspective is Donald Trump, and she was laughed off the stage there too. And Keith Ellison, by the way, is running for DNC chair, I believe, against Howard Dean. So if you want any kind of new outlook on things, I believe it starts with Keith Ellison, and I wonder how many people within like the mainstream Democratic Party are going to fall in behind him.
But again, he'd be a part-timer, so not great.
That's in fact the first step, is actually hiring someone to deal with these deep-rooted and incredibly complex problems.
They should get Ryan Priebus. He seems to be doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, if you haven't noticed from my argument, I think this is a full-time job. There is a lot of work to do. It needs to be cleaned up. I would not devote only 4 hours a day to this.
Yeah, but going back to the issue of how people miss it, I think it starts with a cultural assumption that, well, Donald Trump is a joke. Of course he can't win, and of course he shouldn't win because, you know, how can anyone not want to support Hillary Clinton among the kind of chattering classes? But then also when people talk about the failures of polling models and so on, if you compare this to previous elections, like say 2012, for instance, was also a failure of polling in as far as it underestimated Obama's eventual lead. But that seems so less consequential because the difference there is Obama wins by 7 points instead of 4 points, as opposed to instead of Clinton winning by 2 points, it's Trump winning, or like Trump not even winning the popular vote, but winning the Electoral College and suddenly becoming president, which seems so much more momentous. And so I don't know if this is a systemic problem with polling models or so on, but there's certainly something that needs to be looked at there. And I know there have been attempts to compare this to Brexit, where also the polls were off for most of the process there. And also, like, by the way, if people think that 2016 is surprising or bad, look ahead to 2017, where in about half of Europe there are national elections coming up where you also have the same trends being displayed with kind of authoritarian populist candidates, and where polling at the moment says that most of those are behind, but even that's by a small margin. If that polling is wrong, this could be like a Western-wide trend by the end of next year.
Right. I think the French elections come up next year. Is that right, Dom?
Yeah. Marine Le Pen, again, behind at the moment, but what does that really mean in context right now?
And do you know the numbers right now for Marine Le Pen?
I don't offhand. But it's interesting to me to note that you look at how the same phenomenon is playing out all over the West. So I think the comparisons between Trump and Brexit are misleading for a number of reasons. But then you also look at Spain, let's say, where Podemos won, and there's been a shift towards like the far left over there. You look at Greece, where both the far left and the far right have ascended to power, and then the far left moderated once in office and then being punished for that. And so this is playing out in different ways all across the West. The one trend that seems to be playing out everywhere is the kind of technocratic center left that was inaugurated by Bill Clinton, along with like Tony Blair, Gerhard Schroeder, and so on, and which has culminated in Hillary Clinton, is just being comprehensively punished everywhere. So this is something which I think the Democrats have to move away from if they want to pay heed to that trend.
Yeah, by next year we could have a Western world where Angela Merkel is the last center-left leader standing.
Right, which even that's stretching the definition very loosely indeed. So it's big
center in that case, if you want to describe it that way.
Right. So let's talk about some of the post-mortem stuff a bit more. So going back to the economic arguments, if you want to situate it in a larger trend, it's not clear that a focus on economics alone would have actually done any better. So obviously the Sanders fans are jumping in saying that Bernie Sanders would have won. Not clear that that's true, but you look at, for instance, Zephyr Teachout losing, Russ Feingold losing his Senate race, West Virginia, which there's been debate about the role of the white working class, elected Jim Justice, this billionaire coal magnate, and you look at specific policy measures which come up. So Colorado overwhelmingly rejected single-payer healthcare. And you can say that's because of features of that individual bill. But it shows that when this stuff comes up on the ballot, it's not as popular as you might like to think. And this purely materialist argument of, well, if you just sell them a better economic future, it's going to work. I don't know how falsifiable that really is, because whenever it's been tried and failed, the argument is always, well, if you just double down on that and really fully committed to it, then it would be more successful. But that's, you know, that's not easy to actually substantiate.
Yeah, I think the thing that I've come away believing most strongly at the end of this election is that for a large portion of the country, the most important thing is the charisma of the candidates at the top of the ticket. So the economic message is important to some subset. There's still micro-targeting that needs to happen here in terms of making sure you have the right message for the right groups. But that essentially gets overwhelmed by who is more likable for a large swath of the electorate.
Yeah, that's something that we kind of saw that surprised me again with the election for president. There are people who like didn't vote, right? You know, everyone says that negative campaigning is the most effective thing, and it's very effective. But at the end of the day, people prefer to vote for someone and not against someone, which I think is why you saw voter turnout so low. And I think bolsters the argument of the Bernie people. I don't know that they're right, but Bernie was someone who would have been more likely to get votes for him than was Hillary Clinton.
Right. And the Christmas theory, it sounds very like simplistically attractive. But if you look over the past 40 years, let's say, so Obama versus Romney, Obama versus McCain, clearly Obama by far the most charismatic candidate. Bush versus Gore, Bush versus Kerry, again, easy win for Bush. Clinton versus Dole, Clinton versus Bush the Elder, again, Clinton by a heavy margin. I think Bush versus Dukakis is kind of a push. Neither of them is really that effective.
Low energy.
But Dom, we've had two elections in that stretch where the losing candidate got more of the popular vote. You know, Al Gore got more votes than George Bush, despite the charisma.
Sure, but to continue the comparisons, just to finish those quickly, like Reagan versus Mondale, Reagan versus Carter, and then Carter in his own right versus Gerald Ford. Like, it is a pretty consistent trend. But I think that what you're saying speaks to the wider issue of like this gap between the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. Like, that's not going away. Despite people's protests about the Electoral College system now, that's not changing. And so that's a reality that has to be adapted to.
I wonder how long it takes before we are Japan, where parties are recruiting celebrities to run in major elections. Like, if there's no one right... Well, I'd say he was not recruited, right? He sort of created his own action. But when does Howard Dean call up George Clooney and tell George Clooney that he's running for president in 2020? Is that tomorrow? Is it a month from now? Like, when does that happen? Because it's probably going to happen.
That's what I was wondering. That's what I brought this up, and I'm glad that we're kind of getting into it. I brought this up very early on about Trump really harnessing the media and wondering if now we're almost potentially entering an era when people that have grown up with social media of all kinds of sorts and have never had their eyes off of screens, like we're almost potentially getting to the point where you could theoretically down the line almost have to be a celebrity to even have a chance in any major election.
Well, that's another popular theory that the candidates who have been winning in these dramatic ways have been the ones who are able to harness new mediums most effectively. So you think back to JFK and the first real like television candidate, and then going ahead to Obama, who I think was the first like internet candidate. You can make an argument that Donald Trump is the first social media candidate in that way, where even though he spent far less on advertising than Hillary Clinton, and despite all of the protests about money is what wins elections now and Citizens United and so on, he spent far less money and also had the vast majority of the media arrayed against him, and somehow that all worked in his favor. So the fact that he was able to overturn that paradigm so effectively is, I think, it has to be a sign of things to come.
Well, I can't speak as much to the social media aspect of it, but as someone who is occasionally on television, you know, that like you see, again, you saw it with Hillary Clinton, but like a lot of people who are good on policy or who are good at governance, they can't make the shift to be compelling on television. Like to go on TV and to be to get people to want to watch you and pay attention to you, you have to dial it up to 11. Like you have to be a bigger version of yourself. Whatever you do in front of a camera is shrunk down by the time it gets to people's TV sets. So that's something that comes very naturally to someone like Donald Trump. to Bill Clinton, to George Bush, to Barack Obama. But you have to like regular you, and then like Price is Right contestant you. You know, the latter is always going to be better television and is always going to get more people watching and listening. I mean, Scott Walker flamed out in the primaries. He was considered – I actually thought he was a strong candidate to be the Republican nominee as of like 2 years ago. So, haha, shows what I know. But he's just not interesting. He's – you know, you watch him. He debates or he's on TV. He's not – he's there's nothing to see there.
It's just right. I mean, you can throw $80 million at Jeb Bush and it's not going to get you anywhere.
Right, right. But when you – like if he can – any of these guys, if they can be a bigger version of themselves, if they can come out there and have all this high energy and they're talking and they're connecting and they're passionate and the passion comes through but it seems genuine, then you know that's really important. So it doesn't have to be an actor but you know or a celebrity, but those people have that particular skill to keep eyeballs on them and to get people to consume their message.
And this – I think maybe undersells just how transformational a candidate Barack Obama was, because he got an unprecedented share of votes. And you look at the broader trend lines, we say that Hillary failed to get that turnout properly, but really she's just returning to the levels which we saw with her husband, with Al Gore, with Dukakis, with candidates before that of a high 20-30% of the electorate. And so Obama kind of breaking through, getting 31-32%, that might just be an aberration, something which we can't hope to return to. And so when we blame him, when we blame Hillary Clinton for not keeping the Obama coalition together, we can say, well, almost any candidate would have struggled to do that. We saw that in the midterms even, where voters who turned out overwhelmingly to vote for Obama just didn't show up to vote in the midterms. And that's why the Democrats had a tough time partially in 2010. But I guess the other side of that is, you're running against the least popular or the person with the highest disapproval ratings of all time. Surely just running a low variance candidate who can sell a basic message properly would be enough to carry them over the edge. And Hillary, despite all of her flaws, was almost able to do that.
Well, in fairness, even Obama 2012 couldn't maintain the numbers of Obama 2008. But the truth is, like, once you get those people out and voting the first time, it shouldn't be as hard to get them to vote the second time or the third time, right? Like, the highest bar – I'm sure there's studies on this, but to me it seems the highest bar is getting them to go do it the first time. Like when a candidate's trying to raise money, right? Like or any company is trying to get money out of you. Like the hardest dollar to get is the first dollar. Like once that first dollar has been spent, then the pipeline is open and you're gonna donate more to the candidate. You're gonna buy more of the cosmetics or the whatever the hell it is you're buying, or tools or whatever. Sorry, not to be like gender specific. women give a dollar and then they give a – no, it's not like gender based. It's everybody. But it feels like that voting should be the same thing, right? You get people to the polling place one time. You get them first of all, you get them registered one time, and for the most part, they're registered. I'm not sure all the voting rules in different states, but in Illinois, I registered once and I'm always registered. And you get them to vote the first time. Go vote again. So the amount of energy required to activate a voter who's voted before is lower. It seems to me it should be lower than the amount of energy it takes to activate a first-time voter.
I'm going to – Dom asked me this question the other day, and without telling you what my answer was, I'm curious to hear what you two say. Do you feel like had there essentially been no Hillary or no Bernie, we would right now be looking at President Martin O'Malley? Had just the most generic zero candidate run from the Democrats that wasn't liked or disliked necessarily, would we be looking at that person as the winner?
I think yes, because Martin O'Malley – well, with Martin O'Malley had issues as the mayor of Baltimore. To answer your question, if you have someone who doesn't have the deep history of scandal-ish around them, if you don't have someone who people sort of instinctively understand right or wrong to be corrupt or to be an entrenched politician, then yes, I think Martin O'Malley could have won the election or equivalent, or Lincoln Chafee or whoever.
Right.
Well, not specifically Lincoln Chafee, who had what, like three donors, like two of whom were his alternate personalities. I think like he had a donation from Chink and Lafey.
Right, but just like empty suit with a D in a bracket next to his name probably could have won the election here.
Mike, what do you think though?
Yeah, so I think if I can swap Martin O'Malley for Joe Biden, then absolutely yes. I think Joe Biden wins.
Biden, yes.
Easily.
Biden, yes. Biden would have appealed to the Rust Belt. Biden would have won Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin. That's what Biden does.
Yeah, my answer was yes too, by the way, just for the record. I thought
he appeals to low inform, like Biden is just so charismatic and very easily appeals to low information voters. He's a compelling speaker. I'm torn on the generic, and Martin O'Malley is a perfect person to talk about as a generic Democrat. If you think that why the Democrats lost is because the turnout operation wasn't a success, then it's hard to make the argument that any other non-charismatic Democrat gets the job done. If you think that they lost because of the turnout operation, and that's necessarily tied to Clinton scandals and people's dislike specifically of Hillary Clinton, then Martin O'Malley definitely wins. And I haven't come up with an answer to that yet. I'm not sure which one I think is true.
I think the latter has to be right. I mean, how many voters, even Hillary voters, how many voters in this election really hated both candidates? You know, to use an anecdote to try to like make a bigger point, which, you know, is completely valid. My uncle has been a conservative voter for a long time, and he hated both candidates. Like he decided eventually he couldn't vote for Trump, but he also couldn't vote for Hillary. So we wound up writing in Mitt Romney, which great. I said, like, you
cool.
know, I said, you're aware that like no one's going to page Mitt Romney and he's going to like go to his phone and call him back and be like, hey, what's up? Like, hey, you got to vote in Florida. He's like, oh, I'm back, baby. Like, you know, pick one of the two and vote for him. But there are a lot of voters who hated both candidates. And if you can give them something to hate less, like to clearly hate less, then I think you take enough of those votes away from Donald Trump to swing the election. It's such a close election.
How did you say didn't vote for Hillary but voted the rest of the way Democrat down the whole ballot?
Right. Some of those might not have liked O'Malley, right? You might have had a different coalition that wasn't crazy about O'Malley or whoever the default Democrat is. Like there's no candidate the Democrats could run where some faction of the party would be like, whoa, 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 I don't like this guy.
Right. And so this ties into, I think, the debate about the role of both race and gender in the election, which we'll kind of tread lightly on. So it's very tempting and easy, I think, to just say, oh, well, all Trump voters must be racist. And regardless of what you think about that statement, and I think it's true that to vote for Trump, you have to overlook or at least not care that much about the obvious racist and sexist things that he does.
They're enablers at the very least.
Right. I mean, these are people who voted for Obama. Like I said, a third of the Obama coalition was white working class voters. And here's a point which I haven't seen made anywhere else. These are the people that voted for Hillary Clinton in her primary race against Obama 8 years ago. Like you think about Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia. These are the states which gave her life during the mid stages of that race. So clearly these people, the door isn't shut. Like you can reach out to them, but it just seems like over the past 8 years, the failure of messaging has been so vast and so all-encompassing that they're slipping away very rapidly.
Yeah, they're not going to be gone forever. I mean, I still would expect in 4 years that the states that are traditionally blue would remain blue. I mean, I think this is the aberration this year.
Yeah, and I think, I mean,
those three states.
I'm guessing, sorry to keep talking over you, I'm guessing Trump will probably not be exceeding a ton of people's expectations. Maybe that's just me being me again, but that would be my take, is potentially, like we've been talking about, these next couple of election cycles, there are a lot of people hitting the polls to kind of take down the Republicans having such a stranglehold on things.
Yeah, and I think if you want to make the argument for what would Trump do that would let him keep those voters in 2020, you'd have to think that it would be infrastructure spending that puts people to work, paired with not blowing up Obamacare, because a lot of the people in those states are newly insured because of Obamacare. So for that to happen, you have to think that he will go with Steve Bannon. There's sort of this chain effect of logic that if he's thinking, and if his advisors are thinking, like, be a two-term president, then you go the, like,
oh my God,
weird Bannon route. You push through infrastructure spending. You do all of these things that are specifically targeted to those voters. And then you run again. But he might be thinking, oh God, why did I do this? Let's just let other people run the show. I'll come to to Washington like 2 days a week. And then in 4 years, I'll start my TV network. And Hillary seemed to figure it out. Seems like there are a lot of expensive speeches you can give. That sounds great.
Yeah. But if he does those, that's a terrifying thought, the two-term thing. If he does those things, though, if he wants to spend on infrastructure, then the tax cuts aren't going to work. Or if they do work, he's going to run up the deficit to unprecedented levels.
No, the tax cuts would be fine. You just run up the deficit to unprecedented levels. Why would he?
That's essentially what Reagan did, right? And that, despite the ideological inconsistency or whatever, that didn't have any immediate blowback on him. But Colin, to go back to what you said a while ago about why would so many women vote for Trump, and we saw this actually where Trump somehow gained among every group, and the gains he gained with least were white voters somehow. I think the only logical answer to that, and the one which maybe makes most sense for the election as a whole, is if Trump is so thoroughly normalized, like if you see this as a relatively standard election, so you substitute Trump out for generic GOP candidate, given the priors that we had, where we've come off two terms of one party in office, where that party's president does have high approval ratings, but the economy isn't in great shape at the moment, and there are lots of other things going on, and then that party runs a fairly uninspiring candidate who doesn't reach out to the swing voters that you need to target, and then the other side does have a charismatic candidate who can open new ground. It starts to look a lot like Gore losing to Bush in 2000, right? It's not so outside the realm of possibility that it just couldn't have happened. Like
I really feel like Donald Trump is that far outside the realm of a normal, reasonable political candidate. Yeah, I do. I feel like specifically Donald Trump, I remain adamant. I cannot fathom how a woman could justify voting for Donald Trump.
I mean, I can't either, but then you had all of these conservatives during the primary who said, I am never voting for Trump under any circumstances, just queuing up to kiss his feet the moment he won the nomination and then won the presidency. And that was one of the most striking things to me, that like evangelicals still voting for Trump at the usual rates, when Trump is, like, if Trump had existed in the Bible, he would be some kind of biblical villain, right?
And he doesn't even pretend to be religious, which is incredible right. And unparalleled for a politician.
Right, because everyone across the political sphere has just taken it for granted for so long that these religious values matter, these social conservative values matter. You have to appeal to them if you are a conservative candidate. Maybe Trump is showing that as long as you have certain other things in play, as long as you have the charisma, you can move on to whatever territory you want. So, like, yeah, before it might have been the death knell for someone in the GOP to sign on to Obamacare. But if Trump comes out and vocally says, okay, we need to change the healthcare system, and this is a good first step towards doing that, maybe they fall in line. Like, I don't know.
Well, I feel like a big percentage of, the religious right probably came into this election thinking, I've spent my entire adult voting life voting for Republicans, essentially, assuming they've been voting since like the Reagan era or so. And I am certainly not voting for Hillary Clinton. So I guess I'm voting for Donald Trump.
I also think that there's something to say that if Republicans had held the presidency for the last 8 years, I think fewer of them would have voted for Donald Trump. I think they wanted it more because they've been out of power at the presidential level for two cycles now.
And for many of them, I think it was exactly Obama being that president who really energized them and wanted made them turn out. One of the most striking statistics to me was this election had the most straight ticket president and Senate voting record ever since the direct election of senators was introduced in 1914 or so. Every single state that went Republican had Republican senators and vice versa for the Democrats. So to me, because you would think there would be a lot of Republicans who will happily vote for their Senate candidate or their House candidate, but who won't want to vote for Trump.
I hadn't heard that. I'm definitely surprised by that.
That was stunning to me. Like that shows that Trump has kind of been normalized in a way that you wouldn't expect. And that's one of the most terrifying things, because we have this strong reaction against Trump now. In 2 years' time, you still need that flame of resistance to be burning brightly, or there's just no hope, right? Like, you need people to not see this as a new order of things for there to be any kind of fight back.
Well, ostensibly he'll still be horrible, you know, there'll still be lots of things to push back against. And one of the things, actually an actionable step that you can take if you want to be part of the resistance to all these horrible things he's trying to do, is to make sure that you are paying for subscriptions to the New York Times and the Washington Post and whatever your local newspaper is, to make sure that you're putting money into journalism to support the ACLU and to support the Southern Poverty Law Center, who do really great work on behalf of civil rights and on behalf of people who would have a hard time defending themselves for all sorts of important rights that Americans have. So for someone like me and for Mike, I assume, who are going to be paying less in taxes for the next 4 years, you know, the money I save from taxes, that's going to go to fight the guy who's lowering the taxes.
The one other thing I would note is, so we're about 5 months on from Brexit now, and so we're starting to get the insider accounts of what was going on in those campaigns. And one of the things that really struck me the most was the Remain campaign thought, okay, we're going to lose on the cultural issues. Like, we can't make a cultural case for EU membership. We haven't been at the heart of Europe for so long, so we just can't do that. And also on immigration, which they thought would be an issue, but one which they could neutralize. Like, we can't win that, but that's okay. What we're going to do is we're going to focus entirely on the economy, and economic issues are always the ones that win elections. That's been proven since time immemorial, and that's how we're going to do it. And the Leave campaign essentially said, okay, we agree with that, but what we're going to do is we're going to fuse those economic concerns with cultural concerns over immigration and sovereignty and so on. And by making those two so linked that you can't argue for one without arguing about the other, we can dominate the discussion on those issues. And so whenever someone, like whenever the Remain campaign wheeled out some expert from the IMF or the Bank of England to say how bad Brexit was, they could contrast that with how out of touch they seem to be culturally. And so that allowed them to dominate kind of every facet of that argument. And I think the same thing could be at work ahead here, where, like, Bernie Sanders, for instance, okay, maybe his message of economic populism would have appealed more in purely materialist terms, but what does Bernie Sanders say about, you know, trade, immigration, and so on? Like, you need to be able to make a coherent message across all lines on those issues. And I think a lot of the kind of figures that the left wants us to move towards now just aren't capable of doing that.
I read a great tweet storm this morning, and boy, is that a weird sentence. That's 2016 for you. I read a great tweet storm this morning about persuasion and about how logic is like the worst way to convince someone to change their mind on something, that you have to have like the emotional appeal and you have to have the ethical appeal along with it. You have to make them feel it. And once they feel it, like, that sort of opens up the channel that you can get some of the logic through. And yeah, like, what you see is that with Brexit and with Trump, and that there's this emotional appeal because they don't have the logic to fall back on. They can't use the logic. You know, I think if you're in a position like Hillary Clinton is, you know, where she knows that she's the only candidate who's qualified to be president, and she knows that she's the only candidate who has policies, when you're in that position and you're a smart person, you try to fall back on what works for you, which is the logic, but that's not the persuader that works on a ton of people. So you do see that it's the emotional appeal. And that goes back to what we were talking about with being loud on television. Like, it's all connected. It's all making it visceral instead of just trying to go brain to brain with somebody.
Yeah, right. That's a good microcosm for the entire election. I heard somebody talk about somebody who was covering the Trump campaign, who sort of said they had their own usual suspects moment where they realized, why did the Trump campaign insist on putting them in pens, the journalists, in these like penned off areas? And he was saying it was so that the Trump rallies and the attendees could have this visceral reaction of Trump saying, look at what I've done for you. I've captured these elites and I've put them in a cage, and you can yell at them and scream at them right here at my rally if you want to. So they were essentially the show, and they let people have this amazing emotional catharsis that Donald Trump gave them by coming and yelling at all these elites that he literally put in a cage for them. So,
Scott, there's a book which you might have read, I'm not sure, called The Political Brain by Drew Weston.
I don't recall. I read a lot of books, I've been out of school now for, 50 years, 60 years, I want to say.
I mean, Colin should read it for the first time in, like, 15 years. It would be a good...
It's on the list.
But good way back into the world of reading. But
I mean, he should read it, or he should read.
Well, both. But it's about the role of emotions in political arguments and advertising. And I remember reading that book as 14 or 15 year old back in 2007 or something. And then when Obama came along, it to me validated everything that had been mentioned in that book. And now coming along and seeing the kind of very tepid messaging and very confused messaging of the Clinton campaign versus the, I don't even know what you would call it, the Trump campaign. Like, all of that seems even more valid now.
maybe it's not even that we're going to get an influx of, oh, you've got to be a celebrity to be president. Maybe it is. You've got to harness the media and really appeal to people's emotions and make them feel things if you want to be president. And you really need to channel their hearts and not their minds.
Well, again, yeah. Go back through the list of winners of presidential elections, and you'll see that that lines up pretty well with the candidate who had that skill.
And a lot of the punditry now has been focused on the cultural divide. So, you know, when Hillary Clinton is wheeling out Amy Schumer and Lena Dunham to try and appeal to voters, how is someone in the Rust Bowl going to connect to that?
Oh, right? Jesus. Who? Which voters do they appeal to? I would love to just understand who those
the already well, the not, people who are already voting for Hillary.
Oh, right. And not even all of those people. Like when I see, this is another aside, but yeah, you can imagine. I did not find that to be appealing. Appealing.
I'm not a fan, and this goes back to the request that we saw on Twitter for some non-privileged white straight, you know, cisgendered males talking about this, because here we, the four of us, can all sit here and bash Lena Dunham, and you know, we've got our own little bubble here where we can do that. But yeah, she's not changing hearts and minds in rural Pennsylvania. They're not saying, oh, there's that girl who was like born to a wealthy photographer and she made that show on HBO, and so she thinks I should vote for Hillary. Well, dadgummit, she's just like me.
Yeah, and so the debate is over whether the people who have been determining the messaging for like Democrats and so on for all this time need to have more empathy for people who aren't in that situation. And regardless of the moral stance you take on that, just as a purely political stance, like if you don't understand these people, then you don't understand how to craft messages to appeal to them, and so you don't have a hope of winning their votes. And given that these people are apparently turning out in much higher numbers than you would expect, like that is a political problem. You need to solve that if you're going to make any progress. Like even if you think all of the opposition to Clinton was motivated by sexism, racism, and so on, like, okay, therefore what? Are you going to be less likely to nominate a non-white or female candidate in the future? Well, no, you're going to take that as a given and work around it to find a message which can fix it, right?
Well, I mean, it has crossed my mind. I'm sure that there are, like, I think a big reason that so many people on the left were so devastated, like, in particular, my sister was a huge Hillary fan, and I'm sure she's still probably not even fully recovered from, like, oh my God, I can't believe Trump is actually the one who's going to go in and be there, and I'm sure it's probably crossed her mind, like, if Hillary, you know, the most qualified candidate that any presidential election has seen in probably, like, decades, can't beat Donald fucking Trump in a nationwide vote, what hope is there for any woman ever? Like, I could see it being the case that a party would be afraid of running another female candidate for a long, long time.
Well, unfortunately, for practical reasons, it probably is the case that you want to nominate someone who's not going to offend some of your less some of your more
deplorable.
Deplorable voters.
Right. Use a word.
You don't want to give like the deplorable voters in your own coalition something to rebel against, which is like a really unfortunate reality. Although, I mean, you saw, you know, the two biggest vote totals in American history both went to an African American candidate.
I might just be more optimistic about this, but I would say after Kerry lost, the general party consensus, right, was that we need a boring white guy from the Midwest to be the candidate, and we ended up with Barack Hussein Obama as two-term Democratic president. So honestly, who knows? I think if the right candidate with the mix of
the key word there, Mike, was boring. Charisma.
Well, no, he was from the Midwest. We got that part right.
Yeah.
Well, Obama was, but you're saying boring. Like the problem with Kerry was that he was boring. I mean,
they needed a Midwestern traditional looking Democratic candidate, somebody who wasn't from a big city, somebody who was more rural, like someone in the John Edwards mold, with the exception of everything about John Edwards.
R.I.P. John Edwards.
Yeah.
Pour one out.
Well, to go back to what you asked earlier then, who do you see as being on the Democratic bench who could step in to fill that void?
I'm sure there are some like toddlers that, you know, my son maybe could do it in 40 years, 50 years. But there's really no, I mean, like, look at the bench, look at the stories that are coming out. Who's next for the Democrats? The top people on all these lists are all in their late 60s. You know, you got Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Okay, they're too old. You've got obviously Hillary Clinton's not going to run again.
Are they too old though? Trump is 70. Clinton was nearing her 70s. Like, I don't think.
Yeah, well, Trump is the oldest person ever. Trump is the oldest person ever elected president. Reagan was, I think, 69 or 68 when he won in 1980. So no, for Hillary would be 73 if she ran it. Not that she. I'm not saying she would, but like,
she's not. No.
More. Well, no one would vote for her. She couldn't win a primary again. But
Clinton Edwards, 2020, make it happen.
Elizabeth Warren is 67, so she would be 71. I would love to have Elizabeth Warren in charge of things, but and she probably is better at connecting with a lot of those voters. She's got a very avuncular is not the word, I guess, because she's a woman, but there's something like familiar and warm about her, but it's not maternal.
Yeah, when I look at her like national favorability, it's not that high. She's not a very popular national candidate.
I worry that she comes across as too like professorial and to put it in explicitly gendered terms, because I think that's how a lot of people would perceive it. I think people see her as like too hectoring or too, you know. I think that is part of the opposition there.
Has Tim Kaine gotten enough name recognition to maybe throw his hat in just to
boring? He's boring.
I know he's boring, but that's what we want, right? We want a boring guy. He's boring.
Cory Booker gets mentioned a lot as another possibility. Julian Castro could be someone whose name. But again, there aren't that many Democrats who with national visibility right now because the party has lost so many seats. So like my out of left field suspicion truly is that there is some Democratic celebrity who comes up. And maybe it's George Clooney. Maybe it's somebody else.
John Stewart
jumping in. Yeah, exactly. John Stewart jumps
in. He's never doing it. He wouldn't do it. But
no, he's got an animal sanctuary in New Jersey now. He's out of the game.
He's happy. And actually, the thing I wanted to bring up earlier is that, and not to get too far off track, but I think that's another one of those like death by a million cuts was not having John Stewart around this cycle
I mean, John Oliver eviscerated Donald Trump 700 times. Did you hear about that?
Yep.
This is the exact problem, though. Like the people who are watching Jon Stewart were never voting for Trump in a million years anyway. So,
but there's some like he could have swayed some of the people who didn't want to vote for Hillary anyway. Some of the people who didn't vote for president. Some of the people who voted for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein. Like it wouldn't have taken much. And for some of those clips that go viral, or like my parents who they did not vote for Trump. But they're the sorts of people who, like, well, could have. And my mom, you know, they vote Republican occasionally.
This guy's parents voted for Jill Stein, by the way. Jill Stein.
Did you really?
by the way, just to talk about that, because that's another one of the places that blame has been thrown of, oh, well, if only Johnson and Stein voters had voted for Hillary, then things wouldn't have happened. Firstly, no. What, you disagree with that?
No, I am with you on this. Unlike the Ralph Nader situation, I am with you now.
Well, it is exactly the same as the Ralph Nader situation, but leaving that aside, you can point to so many groups where if you just move their votes in any direction you want, you could change the outcome. That doesn't actually mean anything. And there are many more people who, like in Michigan, voted down ballot, did not vote for president, or who are registered Democrats who didn't turn out to vote, or who voted for Trump. And like that, you know, say what you want about a vote for Stein is a vote for Trump. They actually did vote for Trump. They literally cast their vote for Donald Trump. So
I've seen the argument like, well, like Gary Johnson got 200,000 votes and Hillary lost the state by like 199,000 votes. So like, no, that's stupid. Like obviously not 100% of the voters for either the third party candidates would have voted for Hillary. And in fact, a lot of them would have voted for Trump or not voted at all had they not had their candidate. But if you look at I'm trying to remember the example, whatever the closest state was, you know, let's say you have a state that's decided by 15,000 votes. Like in Michigan, you know, you have the 300,000 people voting for third party candidates. Not that they all would have voted for Trump or Clinton otherwise, but like there might be another 15,000 votes in there that, you know, a 15,000 vote swing in Clinton's favor. I don't know.
But yeah. So in exactly Michigan, yes, but there are also other states where if you portion out the...
No, there are no other states, Dom. It's just Michigan.
It's just the United States and Michigan, yeah. But there are other states where if you portion out the Johnson voters to like Trump and Clinton in the appropriate measure, like there are states which tip over for Trump now, which you have to factor in too. So like, if you look at one state and you move the votes around however you want, ignoring all of these other factors, then you can change the election. That's true however you want to slice it, but that doesn't actually mean that the third-party voters bear any like political or ethical responsibility for what happened.
Well,
and by the way, and if you're like yelling at Stein voters for not voting for Clinton, there are reasons they didn't want to vote for Clinton. And if you don't engage with those, well, it's the same as the white working class voters. If you don't, like, these are people who should be voting for you. This is the point of your party to bring these people in. So like, run a candidate who can make the election not close anymore.
I reject the argument that the third parties bear no responsibility for this. And it's not – I'm not going to like – I don't think we should like burn these people in effigy, Gary Johnson or Jill Stein. But there is – it was true throughout the entire general election season that either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton was going to be elected president. And if you're voting for either one of them, then your vote is not affecting the outcome. You need to decide either which candidate you like more or which candidate you dislike less, and you need to have a hand in the actual decision of who's going to be president, because only in voting for one of those two people are you having a hand in making the decision of who our president is going to be. So so there is some responsibility on those third party voters for not doing their job, I voted. Okay, well, how did you help this decision? Well, I didn't affect the decision at all.
Yeah, like, I think you can make an argument that this was a singularly important election based on who is going to come out. But I also, it's a repeat prisoner's dilemma, right? If you think about it from game theory, like this happens every 4 years. And if you say that every time, then you never get to affect what you see as positive change as a third party type of candidate voter. So their theory should be you should place votes for these third party candidates, especially in competitive elections, because that's the only way you then convince the more quote unquote mainstream candidates to respect those positions when it counts.
Right. I would also add the people who voted for Bernie or who voted for Johnson or Stein have spent the entire campaign being told that you have to get behind Hillary because, you have to be a realist about things and pragmatic. You have to engage with the world as it is, not as how you would like it to be. And it is of the utmost importance to rally behind one candidate who has the best chance of defeating Donald Trump. I think it's abundantly clear now that candidate was not Hillary Clinton. And that doesn't mean it would have been Bernie instead. But now those same people who are demanding that everyone fall in line behind Hillary aren't seemingly are not willing to undergo the same kind of introspection now to see how they could choose a better candidate in the future.
What do you mean it's not Hillary and it might not be Bernie? Like in this election, that was it. It was going to be Hillary or Bernie. And once it was Hillary, she was the person who had the best chance to defeat Trump. She was the only person who had a chance to defeat Trump.
Right. So in the terms of this election, yeah. But if you think about that actual argument, like, given that nominating Hillary seems like a singularly irresponsible choice.
Yeah, but it wasn't known until pretty late in the game that Donald Trump was going to be the nominee. Like when Donald Trump comes down that escalator, the first thought isn't, uh-oh, like this guy is going to be the Republican nominee. The thought is like, well, this will be fun. Like he'll make good TV for a few months and then he'll flame out and Jeb Bush will be the nominee. But that wasn't obviously what happened.
Right.
But at the point where you decide who's getting into the race, like Donald Trump's not even on the radar. I mean, you could say they shouldn't have run Hillary in the first place because she would have lost to any of the Republicans, which in hindsight, she probably would have lost.
It's true.
Yeah.
But if she's losing to Jeb Bush, that's not as catastrophic as losing to Donald Trump.
Right. Okay. But the argument is always going to be from that perspective, the Democratic candidate is better than the Republican candidate. Therefore, we need a Democrat who is most effective at beating the Republican. So that argument's always going to apply no matter who the candidates are or what the other factors are. I'd also say
that argument lost in 2008, right? Because people were saying the same thing about Hillary when she ran against Obama, that she's the one who can win the general election. He's flavor of the month, and he'll never get there.
And I thought that too back in 2008, and I was probably wrong to think that in retrospect.
Yeah, but you were only 8 years old back then, so
that's also true. Yeah. I don't know. It just seems to me that, like, because also remember, Trump was the opponent that Clinton wanted. She was the one who she thought.
No,
like,
Cruz was the one she wanted.
Hillary
wanted Cruz the most, and Trump was they were at least a little bit afraid of at the beginning.
Right. I think they just didn't want Rubio. So yeah, I do think there's some revisionist history now from some Republicans being like, "Be careful what you wish for. This is what you wanted." I think that in the Democratic circles, there was more fear about Donald Trump because of the populist message than there was about Ted Cruz, who is just like deeply, deeply unlikable to everybody, including his own family.
He did kill all those people in California in the 60s.
Yeah, that's right. The Zodiac Killer has never been found, except on the Republican debate stage.
To bring this back to policy for a second, how do you think Obama's legacy looks now in light of this just world-shatteringly new information? Like, does that change for either of you? Because we saw, like, all of his accomplishments potentially are going to be undone over the next 8 years.
There's a difference between his legacy and how he's going to be perceived. So which are you at? Like his actual, like, the things he did in office and how they last, or how he's going to be remembered?
I guess how he's going to be remembered, but I guess segue into policy if you prefer.
Well, he's going to be Saint Barack forever, because everyone will be able to say, like, look at all these things that he did. If it weren't for Donald Trump, like, it all would have gone great. I mean, the best thing that can happen for his long-term status amongst American presidents is that no one's ever going to see, like, any of the potential bad long-term ramifications of the things he did. So it'll be easy to always say, like, well, like, this would have been so great. That would have been so great. And he now won't have to contend with that. Of course, the downside of that is that all the things he did are going to be undone. So his actual, like, effective legacy is going to be very small. Healthcare, like Mike said, is probably around forever now because, like we talked about, once you have those entitlements, then they are entrenched and you can't get rid of them. So that'll be one. He may well be the last president who didn't destroy our foreign policy. So that could be a thing.
Held it together for the longest.
Yeah, he was the last president to make it 8 years without, like, getting into a war or without, like, you know, nukes or whatever.
I guess you could talk about Libya or whatever, but yeah. So,
I was going to say, Libyans would disagree with that.
Yeah, but my counter-argument would be, you say we're not going to see the long-term negative consequences of things he did or could have done. I would say in bequeathing to Donald Trump the kind of executive state of affairs where, like, you know, there was he did extend surveillance, he did extend the right of the executive branch to unilaterally decide things on foreign policy, to, you know, assassinate people abroad, and so on. Like, that was not questioned over the past 8 years because, firstly, some people just agreed with it, but I think far more people thought, well, Obama's a fairly sane, reasonable person, so we can trust him to do that properly. And also, they weren't inclined to criticize him anyway. But now that it's literally Donald Trump who gets to wield all of that authority, that starts to look like a very poor long-term decision in retrospect, because it wasn't going to be the next 60 years will be President Obama. It's going to be, well, Obama's going to go out of office and then maybe Clinton will win, but eventually it's going to be like Ted Cruz or Mike Pence or some Republican who will do much worse things with those powers than anyone could have expected.
Yeah, I would point to two things that I think will be genuine criticisms he can have for this administration. One is more recent, and it's that Barack Obama, as the leader of the party, cleared the field for Hillary Clinton to run as sort of the heir to his legacy, and that in retrospect was a mistake. The other would be at the very beginning of the Obama administration, he chose as his priority what I also would have chosen, healthcare. I mean, I'm a health economist. I would have done the same thing. But that turned out in retrospect to have been a mistake. Like, he should have done, you know, he should have focused more heavily on economic programs. He should have done something to protect union rights across the country in a more stable way when he had that filibuster-proof majority. Didn't do that. And I can't blame him for it at the time. But in retrospect, I can say we should have done something differently.
Do you think there's any merit to the criticism that Obama, in a more well-functioning political system, would have operated better and, you know, got a lot more done? The fact that he couldn't is not his fault, but the fact that he didn't recognize how obstructionist his opponents were going to be and just essentially declare total war much sooner is...
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I agree with you 100% on strategy. That. Like, even if you just look at the very beginning of the administration, he made an effort to attempt to make the healthcare legislation bipartisan, which took a massive amount of time and completely derailed other things that could have gotten done. Whereas the Republicans went total war, and if we had responded with total war, a lot more would have gotten done. And it just didn't, because there was this sense that he campaigned on being a reconciler and someone who was going to reunite the country. That does require a willing other side. And then if you want to say that then the administration swung even further on the other side of the pendulum and then sort of stopped all outreach efforts after that point, that might be true also. But I think it's definitely true when we started, there was an attempt to do more things in a bipartisan fashion, which was never actually going to happen.
To me, the great disappointment of Obama's presidency and the one that is going to haunt me for haunt all of us for a very long time is that there is no Supreme Court Justice Merrick Garland, that didn't happen, and that Mitch McConnell's obstructionism on the court, unprecedented obstructionism on the Supreme Court, is going to wind up being a big win, and it's going to, you know, they're going to Trump's going to appoint like a 25-year-old fresh out of law school on the court who can be there for 70 years.
Barron Trump is the new Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, I know there are arguments now that they should have put much more pressure on Ginsburg to step down in like 2012, 2013, so they could guarantee that there would be a liberal.
She was never going to do it, and she'll be around it. She could be around in 4 years or 8 years. I don't know that.
No one plans to die within the next 4 years, right? But it's happened to people before.
Well, yeah. Scalia didn't plan to die during Obama's administration. He was maybe hoping to get to the next Republican president to step down. Who knows? I'm concerned that like Clarence Thomas could step down and his seat could go, could be appointed.
Yeah, I think most people expect him to. I think there will be two justices appointed by the Trump administration in the next 4 years. Yeah.
Well, I hope that the big takeaway from the Obama administration is, like you guys talked about, while he was the candidate that was going to be the reconciler and he was going to try to, you know, reach across the aisle, I hope that the lesson has been learned that, at least for now, the right does not seem willing to play ball in virtually any capacity, and quite the opposite. And I really hope that the Democrats finally learn that they have to start playing ball in these campaigns. I am not optimistic that that will happen, but I think that this is hopefully going to start pushing them towards that direction.
Yeah, I think Scott and I were talking about this a few days ago, and I was saying the Democrats have not used the Chicago way, to quote the Untouchables, and they're going to have to start. I don't know if you remember that scene from the movie, but there's was it Kevin Costner and Sean Connery are sitting in a church, and he's explaining, if they bring a knife, you bring a gun. Like, if they send one of yours to the hospital, you send one of theirs to the morgue.
Right, and that's the Republicans keep doing that, and it keeps working, and the Democrats keep doing nothing about it.
Yeah,
there's this feeling in the Democratic Party. Well, I mean, you heard it. Like, they go low, we go high. That a lot of Democrats feel like, well, we can do it the right way.
But how's that going?
But that's
it's going very poorly. Dan Savage was talking last night about, you know, we got to use the Democrats have to use the same tactics right back. And the pushback he got was incredible. You know, that no, we have to play by the rules. You're losing because they're willing to do it. You know, you're going to let yourself keep losing, but you get to have this moral victory. Well, the moral victory gets you nothing. The moral victory gets immigrants deported. It gets gay marriages invalidated. It gets transgendered Americans kicked out of all public bathrooms. You know, like the moral victory is a loss. It's a big fat loss. It's a big L flag. And it's time to wake up and be grown up about this and go start winning.
Right. The idea that, you know, we are the party of facts, we make reason-based policy and so on. Part of that is acknowledging reality as it is, and that reality is you are losing politically and your opponents are willing to, you know, they are not playing by the Marcus of Queensbury rules. They are doing whatever they can to, you know, systematically dismantle the things that you have worked your entire political careers to uphold, and you need to do the same back to them. And writing like a Vox think piece or whatever doesn't get you any closer to in that fight.
Right, or destroying Donald Trump with a John Oliver segment or a Saturday Night Live sketch does not do anything.
That clip of John Oliver from 2013 where he's laughing at the idea that Trump would run and inviting him to run and like offering to like pay his ballot fees or whatever, like that should be seared into the mind of every Democratic voter. Not just as a sign of how just stupid John Oliver is, but just as a...
He really hates John Oliver.
I really hate John Oliver. But also just as a sign of like, this stuff can happen if you get complacent. Don't get complacent. Get out there and start fighting for things.
Totally.
I do want to say, as to SNL, like, there is – Saturday Night Live does have a unique position within especially presidential elections in America where they sort of set the stereotypes that the country believes about the candidates. And you saw that like probably most strongly in 2000 where you had George Bush with strategery and you had Al Gore with the lockbox and the – you know, the – with sort of his caricature that took over, that predominated. And there was a dereliction of that duty in this cycle. Like, you can say that, well, we're just a comedy show and we just tell jokes. And there's this, this compulsion at SNL to try to make sure everything is equal and to go with the false equivalency, but that affects sort of the zeitgeist around the election. So when you present Clinton and Trump as sort of equal, but opposite caricatures, that goes a huge way towards normalizing the behavior. When Donald Trump hosts an episode of Saturday Night Live after the Mexicans are rapists comment, that normalizes Donald Trump. Last week, I was so furious with the cold open to SNL. It started out with Kate McKinnon and Alec Baldwin as Clinton and Trump, and they're arguing, and then finally they're like, you know what? I hate all this arguing. Me too. And they go around and they sing a song together as if, again, as if it's equal on both sides, like this false equivalency. Well, they're both candidates and they're both doing it. So, like, there was no distinction in this hugely important channel, albeit a comedy one. There was no distinction that, no, this guy Trump, this is different. This is bad in a whole different big way. This is bad bigly. And it just wasn't acknowledged. They just went on doing their comedians. They can do what they want, but it has a real effect. It really affects the way that people think about the election.
Well, thankfully, John Oliver was here to set us all straight.
Yeah, I would say even just giving him that oxygen, because Donald Trump, you know, we had all of this outrage coverage of stuff that he said. He got hundreds of millions of dollars in free advertising just because, like, Donald Trump was not trying to. Because you think about all of the, like, the gaffes that supposedly doomed Mitt Romney 4 years ago, right? Like the 47% comment. Donald Trump was saying 10 things worse than that every single day. And so if the rules of normal politics were being applied, okay, maybe that would have damaged him. It should have been apparent pretty early on that that was not the case and that any coverage of Donald Trump was going to continue throwing fuel on the fire. And this is just an analogy, so don't read too much into it. But it reminds me of what psychologists used to say about mass shootings, where, like, if you put these ideas out there and you make them public and it serves to normalize them, even if all of your content is criticizing what they're doing and talking about how bad it is, just having that idea out there has effects on people. And that's a principle of advertising that's been true for a long time now. And so this relentless coverage of Trump, I think you'd be hard pressed to say it didn't work in his interest by and large.
No, I totally agree with that. I know, Mike, you and I both have to get going quickly, although I do want to, at least for me, close out with one. I know there's plenty more that we could be getting into, but I think just as far as to look.
Hey, we'll do part two as soon as you get to the next part of Genius Season 3.
Okay, that sounds good. if not sooner. But I definitely am curious what you guys have to say over under on, or I guess yes or no, and I'll start with you, Mike. Are we going to build a wall for real to keep Mexicans out?
All right, so that, I don't think that's sort of a yes-no question. We're going to build something. Something will happen. They will find some spot where they can take what was a fence and turn it into a wall. But, like, a massive chunk of the border is water. Like, they're not going to build a wall. And the wall doesn't matter. Like, people come in by overstaying visas. They don't come in by actually crossing, like, non-structured parts of the country. Yeah, but, like, if I have to answer yes-no, yes, there will be some kind of wall. It won't cover everything. Mexico's not going to pay for it. It's going to be a waste of money.
There will not be an actual wall. Like, the wall was always a symbol. Maybe there will be, like, some, as Mike says, like some fence that gets extended 5 feet upwards or whatever. But what he means by the wall is it's not that. It's a growing public hostility towards immigrants, towards just civic society in general. And it's, you know, it's, as we've seen in the past few days, it's racial attacks, racial slurs. It's things which will affect the lives of immigrants or even just people who are perceived to be immigrants in the country, regardless of what the actual, like, physical structure is on the Mexican border.
There was a time where he literally did mean a wall, though, and he was asked, and right. He said, yes, a literal wall. So always believe the autocrat, right? That's the saying that's been going around, you know, believe what the autocrat says. That when he says he wants to build a wall, like, he means he wants to build a wall. It's not going to happen. He's not going to get a wall from all the way across the U.S.-Mexico border. That's absurd. But yeah, he did mean it, and he's walking away from it because he says things, and then later he figures out what he's going to say that the thing meant.
Yeah, you know, look, like, but 100%, there's going to be a photo op within the next year.
He'll have a photo op.
There's going to be a mission accomplished banner hanging
from it.
This is what you said, Mike, about how, like, putting journalists in a physical pen serves as, like, this important symbol that he can point to. Like, if he comes out and says, oh, we want a tougher stance on immigration, we're going to tighten up the visa issuing rules, we're going to have slightly more tough passport control, people just, their eyes glaze over at that point, right? But if you say, we are going to build a wall, that captures people's attention. And even if most of that attention is negative, that negative attention helps to reach the minds of the people for whom that actually sounds like a pretty good idea.
The wall just has to be wide enough that it's across the entire background of the shot of him in front of the wall saying that he built the wall.
Yeah. Right, and then the truck pulls away, and then the wall goes with it.
Well, you remember on Arrested Development?
Exactly.
The circle.
Right, exactly.
Well, you could just drive around it and around it and around it.
That's right, that's exactly right. Okay, well, I think we are unfortunately just out of time for today, but guys, this was a lot of fun, and potentially let's do this again sometime. I guess let's go around the horn. Mike, give us where people can be finding you.
Sure, digging a hole somewhere and living in it for the next 4 years.
Well, you got to dig a hole so they can put the foundation for the wall.
That's right. It's the same hole. So I have a Twitter account. It's at Michael Botta. Feel free to come say hi.
All right. Scott, how about you?
I'm at Scott Does Magic. And you, if you're looking for a magician, you can go to scottdoesmagic.com. You can see all my TV clips. You can get from there to seeing my TV clips. I think most of those are at thegreatscott.com. Scroll down. You can see me getting Richard Roper to open a clear can that was full of spring snakes.
So, there you go. Great account. All right. And you guys are podcasting about The Genius over at GeniusCast. Definitely be checking out The Genius. And when you do, check out that podcast.
Yeah, and we're going to do Society Game, too. Yeah, so geniuscast.podbean.com. We will do Society Game at some point. We just have to watch it.
I have a final question now that the two of you are here. So obviously this is a bit hypocritical coming from Dom and Colin, but could we do better than, like, Scott and Mike, or the Genius Cast of Scott and Mike? How about, like, Scotter and Botter, or Botter Scotch is what I come up with?
All right, well, for the Dom and Colin podcast, we are
branding experts, Dom and Colin podcast.
Well, the idea was for people would know what we were doing, and then also to distinguish it from what you were doing, because while you guys were talking about The Genius while being named Colin and Dom, we talk about The Genius while being named Scott and Mike. So we just wanted to set ourselves apart in the market.
Totally different.
Our unique selling proposition. That we are Scott and Mike and not Dom and Colin.
That's right. Totally different thing.
Okay, got it. All right. Well, thank you guys once again. It was a total treat to talk to you. You guys, the listeners, can be following Dom on Twitter at DomHRV. Dom, any parting thoughts from you?
I stand by Botter Scotch. So, you know, reach out to them. Let them know what they should be rebranding as, and we can make it happen. We can build the wall.
Is that our hashtag today?
Yeah. It is. Hashtag Botta Scotch.
Hashtag BottaScotch.
Yeah, perfect. Hashtag Botta Scotch. Perfect. If you made it all the way. That's the first time we've ever done a hashtag for the end of the podcast, but I think that's good.
It's also a good test of loyalty to see who's actually made it, you know, 2.5 hours in now.
I think we've all podcast with Rob and all had that moment and he's like, what's the hashtag? And we go,
No clue, dude. All right. Until next time, you can be following me on Twitter at Colin Stone. You can email the show, domandcolin@gmail.com. I guess if we do another political podcast, email us questions for that. Or if you're a Survivor watcher, which I'm assuming plenty of people are, we are always taking Survivor questions or The Genius questions. So I think until next time, thank you guys so much again for listening. We will talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.